He's the kind of man who wouldn't leave you a crumb on a plate. If City ring up this morning and say, come on then, what's the price? He will say it's X. It's not X minus 10%.
OTB AM. Live weekday mornings from 7:30 on the OTB Sports app.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
You're very welcome to the show. We continue our series today in trying to make life better for you in January, but we also have so much to discuss on OTB AM with Gillette on the football front and on the Novak Djokovic front. If you are energised by vaccines and whether people should be vaccinated and so on and so forth, and exemptions that could potentially be made for top class sports people like Djokovic, or not Djokovic as he may argue, you should be listening in. We're going to go over to Australia to hear what will be a very interesting view from somebody who's actually probably just finished work and is maybe settling in for a beer or two this evening, as opposed to Dan and I, who've just noshed into breakfast this morning. I provided Dan McDonald, my colleague, with some last minute toast this morning, and then, kind of in keeping with our discussion yesterday with Daniel Davey, he told me that he's supposed to be off bread at the moment.
Well, I realised that around
you're on dry January.
I realised that through the around halfway through the toast. I mean, it was just one of these token things that you do, Johnny. Like, like it's January, you're going to try and live a bit healthier. Like, what will I do? Maybe have less bread. Like, you know, it's just something, it's just like one of these arbitrary things that people decide. I'm going to keep doing everything else the same, but if I have less bread, then that might like lead to some kind of notional thing. So what you do is you just go for, like, you know, you go for a wrap or something, you know, like for as your lunchtime meal of choice. If you end up, I've actually just been out and about the last couple of days. So then, like, I assume with these, I listened to a couple of the chats you had on with people the last.
Well, you were glued
days.
All week, really.
I pretty much was, but
you're an early riser nowadays.
Yeah, I am, and I was listening, and I assume like the idea of like having lunch on the run is like one of the worst habits. Like, I don't know if you found that, because you probably spend a lot of time working at home before the pandemic, and I would have as well too, but maybe would still go into games and stuff, you'd be out. And I actually found that a big change at the start of the pandemic, all of a sudden having all your meals at home every day, whereas you'd be so used, like, a couple of times a week to be grabbing something on the run, like, all the time, like, you know, and you end up in the deli or whatever, you know, just because you were out, you weren't there, you go to the office, and you end up sort of doing that classic sort of spar or sort of half unprepared, I'll just grab something. And I even heard you saying about, like, you know, you eat it at the desk, you know, you sit at the desk and have your lunch.
Very
and
unhealthy.
And then all of a sudden, I know the pandemic could have gone in different ways for different people. Like, some people ended up way more unhealthy because they just ended up boozing more at home or whatever, because they're more sedentary. But I actually probably found initially, probably felt a lot healthier in some ways, just because you were actually not eating that sort of, you were cooking all your meals at home, which is a big difference.
Yeah. What are your ambitions for the year 2022? Any, apart from the bread thing that you've already broken?
Well, like, you know, breaking bread. My ambitions in life, or just in health, or
and
just in general?
Journalism as well. Breaking stories a lot lately. probably at the top of your game at the minute.
You've actually put me right in the spot. I haven't really, like, I can't imagine you being a New Year's resolution type of person. Like, you try and do this dry January thing.
Can we out you as the lad who wants to go for pints after the show Saturday?
He's not
out
me for it at all. In fairness, and I heard Daniel Davey sort of agree yesterday that I'm not a big believer in sort of going on a big fast unless you desperately need to do it. Everything in moderation.
Like, including, you know, moderation.
Yeah, moderation. Moderation.
Yeah.
You know, and so I wouldn't be a big fan of, like, going on a big abstemious. Like, it's like sort of a GA sort of club player or intercounty player.
Then goes on the bender
and then you go mad at the end of it. And, like, you'd be a big man for this. Like, you'd do your dry January, and then
I've done it once, in fairness.
Yeah, well, the one time you did do it. You send me a photo on the 5th of February of, like, you at a pub at some point, and I get the same photo every day for around 3 weeks.
Years.
And like what did this actually achieve?
Nothing.
You know, yeah. So whereas if you just like
moderation.
Moderate things just once every 2 weeks.
Nothing moderate about our lineup this morning. OTBM is brought to you live every morning by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Here is what is coming up today on a bumper show. Chris O'Keefe, Aussie journalist, is going to give the local view on Djokovic. Don't know anything about Chris O'Keefe, but I imagine he's going to reflect the views of the Aussie people, because this is a really conscientious.
Why, do you think they all have the same? Think all the Aussies have the same opinion?
I'd say they're like, Djokovic, go home, will you? Because we've been suffering through this for so long. But we listen
to
Chris.
It's a big one for national stereotypes.
It is,
debate,
it is. Because the Serbs are really backing their man.
The Serbs are. Like,
their national hero.
The Serbs are angry. That's the assumption.
They're angry. They're always angry. Especially they kick the ball off the arse of a colleague and it goes in for a goal in Lanzhou Road, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, they've had bigger things happen to them in the last 25 years to make them angry.
Won't be getting to that today, but, even with Chris.
No, although Novak, of course, I mean, I think, you know, Novak, they say, I think it was the Caitlin Thompson was on the show this week, like Novak like is potentially like a future president of Serbia here. So he's basically, like, didn't Shevchenko have a run at it? The boxer, Klitschko, in the Ukraine.
Who's the Kaka Kaladze, had a political career, the Georgian player that played for...
Oh, there is, yeah, and there's a couple
of
them.
What has Djokovic done to be a good president? Like, I mean, it's just, how would you compute him being a good tennis player with being able to run a country? Like, it just doesn't add up for me.
I know.
Especially his vaccines views, by the way.
Because we have such qualified government ministers running every country, everywhere, you know. But listen,
Ireland we're not too bad.
Like. I know what you're saying. I do know what you're saying on that. I didn't have you down as a pro government man. But the thing about Novak is
the worst
like,
government at all. Actually,
he is very much like. I mean, I know we talk about national stereotypes and avoiding them, but there is something about...
We started with Dry January today as well, so we've played our part.
The Serbs, you know, and their place in the world sometimes, I think Novak is a representative for them, and even the fact that he's sometimes, you know, he can be quite unpopular on foreign soil, but is a very proud, Serb, and very strident in his views and sort of in his masculinity and stuff. It sort of ties in to some degree with some of the elements of the Serbian ideal, I think, and that's probably why. Like, he is there. I mean, you see some of the pictures overnight of people with Serbian flags turning up at outside the hotel where he's now detained. Like, it's moved from the airport terminal to the hotel, and you have this weird thing of like pro Djokovic people with Serbian flags turning up. In one video posted up by Ben Rothenberg, the tennis journalist, it appears to be a Serbian fan with a flag wrapped around him, berating someone for wearing a mask at the protest. So it's like some of these people that were like marching up
Capitol Hill or whatever.
Well, no, Capitol Hill or whatever, Kildare Street during aspects of the
some
pandemic.
Of whom we know.
Like, it's not even that, do we?
Yeah.
But
I'm just not going to name him here, but. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll get to that and send the lynch mob to their door in due course. But the point is, like, it's not even, to be fair about Djokovic, and we'll talk about it with Chris, but it's not even that he's just like, it's not about his stance per se on like, oh, whether he's been vaccinated or not. It's also as well tied in with his broader comments over a long period of time and his conduct over
general period. Belligerence.
Yeah, well, on about like healing water and sort of some of the jargon and stuff that it's not so much that he's someone who's saying, whether you like it or not, saying, I've decided I don't want to do this and that's that. It's more that it's the extent to which he's gone to present himself as something of an anti-science figure, which probably hasn't been entirely helpful.
Let's get back to what's on the show today. We're all about going off on... kind of tangents on
tangents
the show this morning.
Thing, but yeah.
What a bumper show we have. So Chris O'Keefe is going to give us the kind of Australian view on what's happened with Djokovic. Obviously, essentially was in. Now he looks like he's out. Dean Kiley on the show. We're absolutely delighted to have Dean. I think he had 11 caps for the Republic of Ireland after having played underage for England and now obviously a goalkeeping coach at Palace and Ireland. Colin Healy, who will be remembered by many people for... essentially replacing Roy Keane and Saipan back in the day, but I would know him now as the Cork City manager.
I didn't get to replace him. But I don't think we want to be going there.
No, we won't
today.
Eventually,
it's the start of the 20-year anniversary year of Saipan.
I have a special little video that Colin will be much happier that I'll show just to introduce him into the show. It's a short clip from Turner's Cross. I think you'll probably know what that is. And what else do we have on the show this morning? We have JD. This is, I can't wait for this. If you're a fan of Football Saturday, I mean, you'll be absolutely buzzing for you, me and JD, if only for a few minutes this morning, because JD's back in the hot seat Saturday.
He is back. The last time we saw him was before Christmas.
Robbie Cannon is on at 9:10. This continues our, get healthy You know, in January team, Robbie Cannon is the S&C coach.
You say it with a bit more enthusiasm.
Yeah, I know that ultimately.
I enjoyed your food slot yesterday. Yeah, I realised that
most
you
energised
actually,
I've been for a long
you
time.
You have definitely. You've got a career ahead of you if you wanted.
Totally.
Like I could see you on one of those like morning breakfast shows,
Keith Foy type chef,
where you're casually stepping across like to meet the chef in the kitchen, and then you like go on an impassioned rant about fish consumption in Ireland.
I'm sorry, Dan.
And don't.
We're in the sport.
You're off again.
We're in the sport and game, but like, there's only so much you can say about Man United every second minute. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there are other important things in life, like
fish.
Getting your fish in.
Fish.
You know.
Yeah. I don't think that anyone has ever done that sport and cookery hybrid program, but maybe this could be your thing. Like, you could do one of those meal and minutes books, but then interspersed with sort of hot takes on the sporting day.
Yeah.
Around it.
It's
it, could, it could sell. It could sell up to 100 copies, I'd say.
It's mad to think, dear viewer and listener, that like it's not unusual for Dan and I to nowadays in WhatsApp group exchange photos of what we've just cooked.
But that's what we did during, not in the more recent. You've started to get into it again in the last while, like sending pictures of like, you know, fillets and what did you send the other day? Was it mussels or something?
Cooked mussels the other night.
Yeah, very impressive. Yeah.
Not the guns anymore. The gym days are over.
No. Yeah. Are they? Are they over for you? Yeah. You have to discuss this with Robbie. I'm not sure if they should be, really.
We've 17 minutes at the top of the show to get through. This is kind of
like... We've done 11 of them.
We will get to the papers later on, but just in the back page, FAI face big World Cup call with Euros bid in the cards. This is a fascinating story.
Yeah. So this has been, in fairness, like this has been hinted at sort of a couple of times in recent months. Something in the Sun, I think, last Saturday as well. And then Martin Ziegler in the Times in the UK reported this yesterday again. And I suppose I would have been making calls about it as well yesterday too, off the back of that. Put in simple terms, we've heard about this 2030 World Cup bid for some time. Mm. Whatever your views on the sort of merits or otherwise of it, and it's been in the ether for ages. I know Micheál Martin got very energised by it earlier this year, but of course it'd been on the radar long before then. And effectively now what's happening is that it does appear that the tides are shifting towards going for Euro 2028 instead. Now, I think maybe some of the early coverage around this would have been suggesting potentially that like they'd get a clear run at Euro 2028. This is the Britain and Ireland bid. Trying to chat to people around with knowledge of the UEFA scene, they were thinking, no, there'd probably still be a race for it, you know, because the way UEFA are doing it, and the key point here is that by March, you have to make a decision whether you're going to go in for the 2028 Euros or not. So effectively, you're then making a decision if you're going in for the World Cup, which you're not going to bid for both. So there's a quick decision coming here on what's the better idea, going for the 2028 Euros or 2030 World Cup, where the vibe, to be fair, has always been that they're outsiders for the 2030 World Cup bid anyway, because of the South American centenary angle, and also then, to be honest, the potential unpopularity of any bid with England in it. You know, they don't have a great track record for bidding for tournaments in recent memories for whatever reasons. And the fact is that Spain and Portugal are in the mix too. So you have to almost win the European to win the European vote before you can even get to the you have to win your sort of constituency before you can get to the next level.
And what stadia would be used in Ireland then?
Well, it was only ever going to be Croke Park and the Aviva.
That's it.
That would have been it. I mean, the big issue with the five nation bid, you know, the five country bid, would be that like Northern Ireland wouldn't have a stadium.
Now, it's not big enough.
And the new casement even wouldn't. At various times, I mean, we had this at the start. You have politicians sort of yellow pack politicians emerging from nowhere saying, let's build a stadium over in Galway, you know, to host the World Cup. I mean, just
casement actually makes perfect sense, notwithstanding, you know, casement should be a very big GA ground, and it'd be great,
but it wouldn't like
it's so riddled with problems. It's
but even
like
Thomond or Parky Keeve would need significant upgrades. Just the criteria that exist for World Cups are pretty stringent. Yeah. So it was always going to be Croke Park and the Aviva, and even within the Euros plan now, you'd imagine that would likely be the case. We'll talk about it maybe as we get on to the
we
papers
have to mention
later
here
on.
Dan, it has been reported in the British newspaper at the Times that UEFA have plans to expand their finals from 24 teams to 32 from 2028. This is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard, and if it suits Ireland, I couldn't give a crap. It's absolutely absurd.
Well, that's the first I'd heard of that, I have to admit, and my reaction was similar. Now, I think point to make around this is that, and certainly from chatting to people yesterday, is that a lot of this bidding process in the next decade, it's all a bit clouded by this ongoing UEFA FIFA scrap
over
as well.
The biennial World Cup.
So when you're talking about, say, the 2028 Euros and the 2032 Euros, UEFA are doing the bidding process at the same time, they say, for financial certainty. But of course, if the biennial World Cup come in, you'd then be talking about World Cups in 2028 and 2032, or certainly 2032, depending on how quickly they could get such a plan in place if they got the voting for it. Now, UEFA and the South American Federation are now together. They're coming in together. You've got the South American teams coming into the Nations League potentially from 2024 onwards, and they're very much lobbying and working together, and that might even have an impact on bid decisions when it comes to maybe not going too strong against each other for 2030. But there's that bigger picture there. So, but in the midst of it, for that to be thrown in about expanding to 32, where you have then more than half of the associations participating in the finals, it's almost the same type of politics that is governing the FIFA biennial World Cup thing in a weird way. Like, the World Cup has been expanded to 48 teams, as we know.
I've less of an issue with that. Like, well, that's, you know, fair enough, you can debate that.
It's going to make it strange, and there'll be fewer European teams profiting from that than any other confederation. But I don't know. In fairness, the Euros in the summer, the move to 24 was contentious, yet the Euros in the summer just gone was brilliant. But there really isn't the grounds there to move it to 32. Yes, it would be handy to have 8 groups of 4 and all of that, but really the whole qualification process would be severely diluted. But, you know, I mean, would Ireland be in it more often and all? People get used to changes. People never thought the Euro should expand from 8, but to me, to go to 32 is obscene.
How many teams in Europe? Nations?
55.
55 in, so...
55 at the moment, yeah.
So it's a bit like the League of Ireland First Division next season. Most of the teams will end up in a playoff, so most of the teams will end up in the Euros if that were the case. Like
24, your odds were increased significantly, but 32 really brings it to another level, I have to say. So
mention as well another story you have. New year dawns, but thousands at stake for Irish clubs over compensation rules. And this is very, very interesting. So it's to do with James Brown's move from Drogheda, one of the many players that actually has been touted from Drogheda, has moved or is about to move. He's moved to Blackburn, but ends up Drogheda don't actually get any money out of it.
Yeah, I have a piece
as quickly as you can. This is a technical one.
This is very technical, Johnny. You're throwing this to me like very on the sort of, it's like a 60-second countdown here. In short, it's a traditional problem over the years that Irish clubs, you lose players to English clubs for very little money, and when you get to a particular age, they know they can go for free. This was the case with Daryl Horgan, Andy Boyle, Patrick McElhenney, Richie Towell, loads of others I'm probably thinking of. They would let their contract run down and they could go on a free transfer to a club in the UK. James Brown, the difference is that the rules subtly changed, I think in late 20, early 2021. The age threshold on a change, so Drogheda assumed if James Brown went to Blackburn and they would be getting money for it, or went to a club in the UK, they would get money. But it turns out, because he turns 24 in this coming year, they changed the wording from season to calendar year, and that basically means Irish clubs, in short, are potentially losing out on money a year earlier than they thought they might, if you know what I mean. So that's, or a year later, shall we say. So anyway, it's a complicated one, but thanks for throwing it to me there in that sort of quick fire manner. Long story short is, like, you've done this feature all week in Irish players going to Scotland. Like, the broader issue of getting compensated for players going away is still one of the biggest issues in football in Ireland, and clubs still can't really, they're not fully in a position to be able to look for what they should be getting for players, and that's a product of a historical dysfunction.
And as your Irish Independent colleague Rory O'Connor said, we need a football industry in this country so that we can pay players like every week and we're on a more sound financial footing. The news of Johnny Kenny probably going to Celtic as well continues.
There's no probably about that, and like, he's a very good player. Now, the slight contrast with him,
did I see lucrative in your headline in the end though? somewhere? Because like a lot of people would say, oh, it's 150 grand. This is terrible.
Lucrative wouldn't be my word, I have to say.
Okay. And I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah,
anyway.
No, I think the 150K is the initial. To be fair, what Sligo Rovers have negotiated is add-ons and sell-on clauses that mean, like Gavin Bazunu was 500 up front, but it is turning out to be a minimum 1.5 million sale. Matt Doherty was a very small amount up front, but turned out to be 1.5 because of the sell-on. The sell-on clause is crucial, really. That's where you make your money. Should Sligo Rovers have got more up front for Johnny Kenny? They probably should have, yes, but I'm not sure if the league is in a place at the moment where that can become the baseline. It should be, but I don't think it's that straightforward, like, because of some of the quirks of the industry in the country here.
But in defence of Sligo as well, like, they're in a position where they want him under contract, but, you know, Johnny Kenny could obviously just say, well, no, like, I'm just going to wait for a move here. So they have to play their cards right as well. And they go to the player, obviously.
Well, clubs have their also entitlements through compensation rules, which, again, it's hard to get into, but it's becoming a bit of a delicate one now, and it's a real talking point amongst people in football if you speak to it. That the league now is much younger, but what do you do with players as regards contracts? Like, if you didn't have them on long term contracts, you could technically go to clubs in England or Scotland and say, well, actually, under compensation rules, we're due, depending on what category of club they go to, you could say, well, we're due actually 180 grand here by the rules, and that's it.
Yeah.
But in that case, the clubs will say, well, we're not going to pay that. And then they throw it back in the Irish club and say, you're now stopping your player from going. Now, they wouldn't necessarily do that with other countries, but with Ireland, because of the perception of Ireland, it's very much you're getting in the way of the player, you're stopping the player. So what they do is they reach a compromise where they do deals, the player, you know, the player commits himself to the club here, but they put in now a release clause which says, okay, we're not going to have any issues around compensation. Clubs now know if they pay that amount, that's what you get. And like, draw to have a player going to Crystal Palace, Killian Phillips, his release clause, I believe, is €50,000, but there will be maybe other things on top of that. But once you have that release clause in, it limits your compensation payment, but it sort of gives a degree of certainty. Whereas if you don't have some kind of clause and clubs try and go to battle on compensation and say, we're actually due this under FIFA or UEFA, the British clubs will just say, well, we're not going to pay that. And you know, you're then accused of stopping the player from going somewhere. Now, some clubs will pay it, some clubs will have a very good attitude to it, but a lot of them won't, and that's why they end up making like derisory offers, you know, basically a bag of balls and sort of, you know, 5 grand or 10 grand for players who actually, you know, would be worth like substantially more than that. But a lot of it is to do with respect, and a lot of it is to do with sort of quirks of the industry here. Like, even someone like James Brown, people were offended that how maybe he was spoken of, that he's going over to play for an under-23 team. The flip side of that is James Brown, when he was at Drogheda here, was registered as an amateur for the majority of his time. So there's a lot of, you know, we need to get our house in order here to fully be able to look for the money that's deserved.
And what does that say, by the way, about St. Patrick's Athletic manager Tim Clancy? The amount of players he introduced to Drogheda who have just, like, their stock has risen dramatically in the space of a year or two. But anyway, let's get over to Australia. So Novak Djokovic has refused entry to Australia overnight. We'll be crossing over Sydney next to chat to political reporter Chris O'Keefe. But first, the whole story broke in real time in Melbourne. And here is Sunrise Breakfast reporter Nathan Curry with what Djokovic's father made of it all.
Novak's father has just given the Serbian media one of the craziest statements I've ever seen, Eddie. I'll read you a bit of this now. He has told media, I have no idea what's going on. They're holding my son captive for 5 hours. If they don't let him go in half an hour, we will gather on the street. This is a fight for everyone. So just another normal day in Victoria here at the moment, Eddie.
Where is the father, Nathan? He's not here. He's back home, is he?
No, he's not over there. He's back home talking to the media. He's fuming. He's saying his son's being held without a mobile phone. And the whole Djokovic camp is very angry right now. It's an incredible turn of events. Can't believe that when I woke up this morning that this was unfolding.
Yeah, Chris O'Keefe, we're going to hold you captive for up to 5 hours, probably a little bit less than that, because I think it's 6:55 in Australia and you have probably far better things to do than talk to me and Dan.
Boys, I'm more than happy to have a chat about this. This is a story that I didn't think 2022 would bring in Australia. I thought I'd just be having to talk about COVID incessantly, but here we go.
Well, we
Joker
certainly
tries to get to Australia, and we kick him out.
We certainly won't be talking about COVID. But anyway, on the COVID situation, so Djokovic, what's going on here? What's the reaction down there?
Australians were outraged. And you've got to understand, too, that Melbourne, especially the Victorians, they've been the most locked down city anywhere in the world. Mm. People have lost their jobs. People have lost their family members. And, you know, as Australians, our country, we're 95% fully vaccinated, the entire population. Entire population is 95% fully vaccinated. So those lunatic anti-vaxxers, the blokes who don't want to get it done, they're almost shunned to the side. They're such a marginal piece of the community, but they're loud and their pain's in the backside. That's the things that we all see down here. But then we haven't been able to travel overseas. The borders have been shut. There's been cancer patients that haven't been able to get even into states because state borders have been shut. People have lost their jobs because they've refused to be vaccinated. So this is the context in which then Novak Djokovic comes in, a bloke whom not many people in Australia like already, might I add.
Which helps.
He keeps winning the Australian Open. So here's this bloke, public enemy number one, an anti-vaxxer to the extreme, a world-famous anti-vaxxer, and then somehow gets the red carpet rolled out where he thinks he's getting a medical exemption thanks to some, you know, pretty tricky work by Tennis Australia, I might add. Lands at Melbourne Airport and gets asked, hey, mate, so can you show us some documentation, Mr. Djokovic, as to why you think you're medically exempt from having to be fully vaccinated to enter Australia? Because that's the requirements of the country. You've got to be double jabbed to get in. So, Mr. Djokovic, can you show us some medical details, medical records? Oh, no, sorry, I don't have any of that. We'll see you later. Go home. Goodbye.
So Chris, right, so we're doing a morning show here. So, like, a lot of people are waking up to this. And I think last night when we were going to bed, we were sort of seeing the scenes of, you know, reporters outside the airport terminal. There was a couple of Serbian lads playing an accordion or something, like playing some kind of lament to Novak. What's been happening over the last sort of 8 to 10 hours, if you know what I mean? He seems to have been moved to a hotel now. But just in terms of the commentary and what's been happening across the day, your time today, because I know all the politicians were involved, you know, yesterday here. So what's been happening over the last sort of 8 hours or so?
Well, it was funny because, so Novak's not very clever, right? So he's belled the cat by posting on Instagram when he's on the tarmac at, you know, Belgrade Airport. Oh, by the way, I'm coming to the Australian Open and I've got a medical exemption. So he's put it on Instagram and our customs guys in Australia have looked at it and said, oh, hang on a second. And it's sort of set the cat amongst the pigeons, right? So everyone, every politician was into it. All the media were outraged. And people on my radio program in Queensland and New South Wales, they were furious, the public, furious, furious, furious. So then when Novak finally arrived in Melbourne late last night, when it was found out this morning, it sort of broke on all the breakfast television programs, our time in the morning, that the visa had been cancelled. Now, you've got to remember something. Our Prime Minister here, he's doing it a bit tough and he's got an election in a few months. Mm. So I think he needed a distraction. But nonetheless, the visa was cancelled and everyone was, good on you, kick him out. They're calling him Novak Djokovic. Get rid of him. He's a joker. We don't want him here because he's spitting in the face of all Australians who've done it really hard during the pandemic and try to do the right thing. But the issue now is Djokovic has sort of empowered the anti-vaxxers a bit, hasn't he? Oh, you know, the freedom fighters. So you've got that, you know, and, you know, the photo of, there was literally two blokes at the airport. One bloke with it looked like he had a harp or a harmonica and he was sitting there, you know, we're very sad that we're missing Novak. Well, no one else was sad in Australia. People were outraged that he was coming in the first place. And then he gets sent to immigration detention, right? So he's at the Ridges, which is like a one-star hotel, you know, that serves cold ham sandwiches on stale white bread. This is Novak Djokovic. He's worth $300 million. And then he lodges a court appeal. So he's in the courts right now in Melbourne trying to get it overturned legally. And look, I think he's going to struggle to do that. But nonetheless, he's going to give evidence via Microsoft Teams into the court. So, look, it's a dead set circus, but it's a very entertaining one.
If my experience with Microsoft Teams is anything, that'll be a struggle.
Just hope
well.
The Wi-Fi is okay in that one star hotel. Otherwise, it's going to be a real issue.
They're going to be rationing the Wi-Fi for Novak. But just on this as well. So what was this exemption? Like, why was he allowed in the first place? What did they come up with here?
So this is the thing that nobody can understand, right? So Tennis Australia is a very influential and powerful body in Australia, given it's, you know, a host of Grand Slams. So it's no small thing. So they've got. So what they did, they said they set up an independent medical body that looked at all the paperwork from all the players coming in and people who wanted medical exemptions to get into Australia. Because as the rules stand in Australia right now, if you're not double vaccinated, you're not welcome. You can't get entry unless for very, very, very few medical reasons can you get an exemption. Now, Tennis Australia reckon they went through Novak's, all of his medical details and paperwork, and Tennis Australia, who want the number one defending his Australian Open title to play in Melbourne, deemed it that Novak Djokovic should be given a medical exemption and play in the Australian Open. Now, that's what Tennis Australia told Novak Djokovic. Now, the federal government, who lets people in and out of Australia, didn't know anything about this. So what happened was Novak legitimately thought that he was going to get a medical exemption because Tennis Australia told him that that was the case. But they're auto-generated visas. Because can you imagine a bureaucrat trying to look through, or a public servant trying to look through every single visa application, checking the medical records of every single, hundreds and thousands of people a day? Wouldn't be possible. No one would ever be able to get in. So they auto-generate the visas. And then Border Force are the ones, our customs are the ones when you arrive in the country that they can, at their discretion, check the paperwork to make sure that you fit the bill for the visa. And because he put the thing on Instagram, everyone wanted to know if it fit the bill. So Border Force pulled him aside, and guess what? He didn't fit the bill, so his visa was cancelled, and he should be on a plane back to Serbia probably in, you know, 12 to 24 hours after his court appeal's done and dusted.
Interesting to see if he posts from the tarmac this time. But what about this point, Chris, though, that, and again, I saw this going around from maybe people who might be deemed to be more supportive of Novak's position. Are there other players participating in the Australian Open that are believed to have sort of benefited from similar exemptions, or has that been clarified at all?
It was interesting because they reckon there's three. There's three players that Tennis Australia managed to get in, but they didn't post on Instagram, did they? They just came in quietly.
That's basically it. It's just because they didn't alert themselves.
The problem was because Tennis Australia is in damage control, they've been telling the newspapers, oh, there's three other people that came in on medical exemptions. Well, the customs and the immigration people in Australia have said, well, we're going to check their records too. So they might be deported as well.
They might have to go to a one-star hotel.
Was it the Copa America last year or something, where it was Argentina or Brazil, and this official came onto the pitch during the game to remove a player who didn't have the right the right documentation? So I have this image now of, like, you know, the players go down for the little break in between, and then someone just comes up and lifts his chair and takes him off the court, you know?
But I
assume, like, they've backed themselves into a corner effectively with that then, Chris, is what you're saying, that will people now be hunting for these three players just as part of some sort of vindication process? It just seems unbelievably bizarre.
But they may have a reason, you know. But yeah, the thing is, Djokovic didn't. So yeah, we all know that he's not vaccinated. So, you know, I think Rafael Nadal put it really simply, didn't he? He just said that he made a decision. Everyone makes decisions, but those decisions have consequences. And Novak Djokovic could easily have been playing in this tournament. He just had to go get vaccinated, like, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the world. So grow up.
Yeah, if you're new to the story, Novak Djokovic's legal bid adjourned till Monday, just a week before the first match in the Australian Open. Djokovic will remain in Australia over the weekend. I've been kind of standing in for other people over the last couple of days, Chris, and a feature of my kind of chats has been the taxi man who brought me in and what he talked about. So today the taxi man was basically saying, I've lost pretty much all my savings over COVID because this business has completely collapsed. And then we were talking about, like, people who refuse to get vaccinated and the pressure this is putting on ICUs and so on and so forth. So it's a very divisive situation over here, and it sounds like it's pretty much exactly the same in Melbourne and Victoria, which has been, obviously, you said, under such strident rules in the first place.
Well, the whole country's been under strident rules. Like, the city in which I live, Sydney, you know, we were in lockdown for the best part of 20 weeks over our winter, your summer. Lots of people died and lots of people lost people, and we're seeing case numbers at the moment that we've never seen in Australia because we successfully kept the thing out. But now we're vaxxed, it's come back in, and Omicron's causing havoc all around the world, right? So people just don't expect. I think this is the nub of it. He could have got vaccinated. He didn't want to get vaccinated. And Australians have got their noses out of joint because there's nothing that we hate more than when celebrities and famous people get the rules bent to look after them. Mm. If the rules apply to all of us, that's fine. But if the rules are bent and favours are given to people who are rich, superstar sports people, well, that's not something that we can cop. And given you sent so much of so many of your fellow Irishmen over to Australia in the last 200 years, you probably feel the same over there.
Yeah, and David Bosang texts in, the next episode of Border Force Australia on UK TV will be unmissable then.
I hope they were rolling.
But Chris, that is interesting, Chris. In your job and in your work, is that the prevailing view of most Australians, what you've reflected there? Are you getting sort of callers or people supportive of Novak, or are they very much a minority of minority? I know there's probably a Serbian community there. You see people out there with flags and stuff like that. I know you mentioned the two people at the airport, but there did appear to be some people at the hotel as well today too. Is that very much a majority view, the one you reflect there, that there is, that Novak would Novak would have been booed if he played, right? Would that have been the view of the court?
It would have been worse than booed. I hope there was no tomato stands out the front of Rod Laver Arena, because he would have gotten chucked at. There was fury in the country, and it is the overwhelming view. And I work for a conservative radio station and a television news company, and I think I got one call, and it was from a bloke who thought that COVID was a hoax. He was the only one supporting Novak. And we've been doing this story for 3 days now. So
wasn't Novak's dad.
It is the overwhelming view. And those, he's going to punch on in the street. I wouldn't want to punch on with Novak's dad, the Serbians. I can't throw. But we saw one of the things I saw that was interesting to me was, I know you probably see the pictures of the people out the front of the hotel in Melbourne. There's probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 people there, but these are the same guys, and I'm sure you've got them in Ireland. These are the same guys that no matter what you tell them, no matter what the science is, no matter what the medicine is, they just won't take it on board. They're upset. They think the whole thing's a joke. They think the whole thing's a conspiracy. The vaccines are going to give you 5G radio, whatever it is. They're crackpots. They're nut jobs. And we've done our best in Australia to largely ignore them. And that's one of the reasons that Novak coming here was, and getting this medical exemption unvaxxed was pretty divisive, because it empowers these guys. These are the guys that are burning effigies of our politicians because somehow they think that they're smarter than everyone else. Yet 95% of our country has been vaccinated. So the 95% of the country that's been vaccinated tells you enough, overwhelmingly, we don't want him here.
Does this not clearly show, Chris, if you don't get vaccinated, you end up in a one-star hotel?
I don't know. Novak will be. I don't think he'll be too happy. Remember last time he came to Melbourne to the Australian Open last year, he was blowing up about the quarantine requirements. He said he was unhappy with the food, and he wanted this person to be in his room and that person to be in his room, and the government just said, "Mate, please shut up, just get over it, play tennis, and go home."
Before we go, Chris, there's only one way to end this. Alana Conan, she's doing work experience, and she's just kind of in on this morning show as a grizzled journalist like me and Dan. Any advice for Alana at all? Tell her to get out.
Tell her to get out if she wants to be rich. That's a good start. If you want to earn a good wage, don't do it. If you are a budding journalist, Alana, I reckon, we'll come out to Australia. We've got plenty of Irish out in Australia. And come and just go. For me, the only way I got my start was throwing myself into absolutely everything, all the different mediums, newspapers, radio, television. Go and enjoy it. Do your work experience. Learn the trade, because it's very rewarding. Because guess what you can do? Talk to people in Ireland about Novak Djokovic.
Beautiful, beautiful. Chris, it's been amazing to have you on.
Good on you. Anytime, fellas. Enjoy the rest of your week.
I don't care what happens in Australia. I want to have Chris back. Let's go to the ads. OTB AM. And we are back. It's always fun to go to somebody who's essentially in a completely other part of the world. I think it's 7 o'clock. PM over there.
That's time difference for you.
That's time difference.
No, but he did reflect the mood on the ground there, because you do sometimes wonder, from afar you're told a country's people feel in a particular way and you can believe it, but you obviously need to sort of hear it. You know, he said he's only had one call in the previous 3 days, and as he said, he works for a more conservative station where there would be probably be a tendency to be a little bit more maybe open to some of those ideas.
Are you worried now about, like, you're not into the rugby, so the Six Nations hardly energised you, but I'd have to say now, I would be really, really annoyed if there were restrictions on League of Ireland attendances. I really mean that.
The National League and GAA is starting as well too, so, like, which is a, you know, sort of a much bigger nationwide event in terms of the reach. I was trying to, like, to suss this out with people, and I think everyone's on a bit of a watching brief at this stage, you know, just with Omicron, and see where it goes with the figures, but it's very much... It's up in the air, and I think what happens for the Six Nations, which is what February 5th, the first game, is naturally going to have implications for other sporting events in February. So the government, whatever rule they decree applies to that, there's likely to be a trickle down effect, I think.
And in terms of, like, because we've spoken about this, the season ticket sales have just been really, really high. I think Shamrock Rovers are hitting towards 3,000 season tickets sold. Derry sold out the Mark Farren stands. Obviously, very good reports from the likes of Shells as well. And it's just been, like, I know Johnny, I know there's a public health situation. Where is the evidence that sending 5,000 people to League of Ireland games is a problem? Outdoors.
But you see, on one hand, we're talking about sort of, you know, Novak there, and then we're sort of coming back and going, well, actually, like, at home here, let's just take a sort of a slightly a la carte approach that suits my particular interest.
It's not my particular interest.
But Johnny, you spoke about this with Nathan yesterday. Like, the fundamentals, I probably agree with you on a lot of what you're saying, but there has to be a consistent policy applied. And it's not, you can't just go, well, where's the evidence that such and such a thing, like... As you know, it's about congregations, it's about public transport, it's about, and as we know, unfortunately, a lot of our grounds here, in terms of entry and exit points, they wouldn't be terrific. Now, they did a great job in the last 2 years in terms of how they managed it when they could. But a lot of the time, that was with restricted capacities, and full attendance has only come in towards the end of last season, very briefly, for a period of time. Now, I would like to think that there is enough evidence there, you know, to support the view that come February, you know, things will be opening up. But you can't just sort of say, well, you know, like, you know, where is the evidence from the past, and this is it. Like, it's going to be tied in with a policy and a lot of other things at the moment. It's going to be tied in with everything else that's going on. I don't necessarily like aspects of that, but as you rightly, correctly pointed out before as well, government support has propped up the FAI in recent years. It paid them 19 million in COVID relief for 2021. If there is a situation where there's restricted attendances, that will affect Ireland games this year, they're going to need help again. So there isn't going to be anyone kicking up over this. There just won't be. Because those government supports, as you know as well, funded and paid wages at a lot of clubs over the last period of time.
They were happy out.
Allowed some of them to do things they wouldn't have been able to do. So you have to think that in mind when assessing the overall picture.
As Chris said there, we're very lucky in this game. We can basically just talk to people and get paid for it, and we can go from live to Australia to live to the Crystal Palace training grounds to meet none other than Dino Kiely. How are you going, Dino?
Hey, morning, lads. How you doing?
What's going on?
Just keep my head down, getting tested every day, and we're in a newly refurbished academy training ground at the moment, which is a little bit bigger than our first team one, but yeah, we're good. Listen, yeah, it's good. Just cracking on, really.
For a man in your early 50s, you're still rocking the old quiff on the hair, I see.
So someone said to me, have you had one of them hair transplants? Luckily, it's all my own hair. I said, if it was a transplant, I wouldn't pick grey, would I? I wouldn't pick grey. So, no, we're all right. I think it's a midlife crisis. That's what my wife, who is also my barber, tells me. She's a master barber, so yeah. Yeah, so she's telling me I'm all right.
I was doing the cursory, looking up Wikipedia before you have a guest on this morning, and you're big into the Nags, actually. You're saying your son is involved in the industry as well, because Dan and I are kind of, well, we've had our stories in the horses front as well. We've actually owned a horse that won in Killarney back in the day, about 20 years ago now.
We owned a lot of horses that didn't win.
What's your background in it, Dean?
Just literally, obviously... used it as a social sort of something away from football. So obviously Premier League football, you're going around shopping and this, and you're having people, oh, what about this? And what about this result? Whatever. And the horse race is just a social event where we'd go and whatever, really enjoyed it. You know, sort of had a bet over the years and just sort of a little interest. I owned some horses myself, but they were all really slow and always injured, which I've found out is not the way to do it. So, but that was good for, you know, in terms of just to go and somewhere different away from football. But then since my son's into it, he's got a great eye. In fairness, he buys yearlings, he goes to the sales. We had probably the biggest winner. He had Rohan win the Wokingham at Royal Ascot last summer. So, in terms of that, you know, he's got some very, very good horses, and I sort of piggyback on the back of that. And the family, we rock up, and we had a fantastic day sort of following all his interests around, really. So it's been good, and it's something away from football. So yeah, it's keeps me off the streets, mate. So
yeah, you're doing other stuff to keep you off the streets. This board in the background, this kind of rectangle, what's going on here? Is this your tactics board for the session this morning, or?
No, this isn't my office. This isn't my office. It's an open plan office. It's been described as an insurance sort of office, you know, where everyone works together and they have like breakout zones, all that new stuff and whatever. So I don't want to sit in there and talk to you. So I've just come into an office there now, but no, nothing. And if it was, it's totally blank. So if that's the session, yeah, we're struggling.
It's like you're telling the goalkeepers, you tell me how we're going to play. I have to say, I'm fascinated by the goalkeeping coach situation. I talked to Dan beforehand as well. He was just making the point about the evolution of the goalkeeper. I think your Twitter bio says, "I kick footballs at goalkeepers." And that you conjures up that image of the goalkeepers warming up for a game and the goalkeeping coach is just giving drop kicks at them to keep them, you know, entertained or whatever. What is it like to be a goalkeeping coach?
Listen, I'll make that sense. A bit tongue-in-cheek. It's a bit simplistic, obviously. But listen, fundamentally, strip it back. That's what I do. But no, you're right. I mean, I think from my point of view, when I played, it's a team sport. But as an individual, as a player, you look after yourself. So everything you do is for you. The minute that flipped for me and I became a player coach and then ultimately a coach, is you've got to look after all that, the stable of goalkeepers under your duty. Okay, you've got to look after all of them. The one playing in the first team is happy as, you know, he's getting on doing his thing. The one behind him, you know, he might need something different from you. He might need a bit of support and sort of TLC. And the third one or the younger ones or whatever they be, they're coming from a different angle. So you've got to be all encompassing. You've got to think of all their needs. And for me, you know, it's interesting. You just got to provide a framework. And I set the tone, you know, in that respect, to create an environment for them to give up their best, really. So it's, I'm the same as you. It's fascinating for me. There's lots of challenges. There's always somebody, you know, when they're driving in the morning, you just think you're getting a goalkeeper and let's crack on and do some goalkeeping. But you don't know what's going on in their lives. You try and get a relationship with them. And again, just take away all the pressures and strains of what it takes to just come and bring your boots and your gloves and crack on. And thankfully, I suppose, here at Crystal Palace and before at Preston and Norwich and West Brom, for me, I've been blessed with good goalkeepers and also good people. You know, it's all, that's really important about the environment and their relationships with each other, you know.
Dean, how different are the tactical aspects of goalkeeping coaching now from, say, the coaching you would have received when you were playing? Like, people talk all the time now about the modern goalkeeper, the ball playing goalkeeper. We have a couple of our own here in Ireland that you're working with in your capacity there. But on a, you know, practical sort of day to day level, are you seeing a different type of goalkeeper coming through? And does that also impact on how you have to coach or how you do your work?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's interesting. I look back and obviously in my areas and this sent me that. I had goalkeeping coaches and they were great. And I've took a lot of stuff that made me feel good as a player that coaches put on for me and used it and adapted it and used it as a base. So I was also blessed that I had goalkeeping coaches. I wasn't in an era where you didn't. So it has evolved. It has, you know, people talk and it's a source of frustration a little bit for me, is the fact that, you know, ball playing, goalkeeper, being able to play out and all these sort of things. When I played, I had all the clubs. So I could play short passes. I could clip into fullbacks. I could play long and try and hit areas and this, that, and the other. But maybe back then, the emphasis or the clubs that your managers and coaches wanted you to use were different. You know, I probably played, the teams I've played for, I've never had the luxury of playing for a top side where I just stand up the other end and that team go and rip somebody apart. I've always played for, like, I'll put it on my CV, I class myself as a winning underdog. So the teams I've played for, you know, you've got a point to prove, you're up against it, there's lots of, you don't dominate possession all the time. So probably the decisions you have to make there are different. But certainly, now listen, you have to adapt your training. There's a lot more passing. There's a lot more elements to it in terms of handling the ball with your feet and making good decisions and finding your way out. You know, when people pressure, where's the passes and where you can get out. So again, I want my coaching to reflect a realism. So if they've got to handle the ball and manage the ball with their feet, then you do put that on in training Monday to Friday. So yeah, there's an element of that, definitely.
Yeah, so like, I mean, Crystal Palace at the moment, I know there's been different managers. So like, what does Patrick Vieira want from his goalkeepers now? What's his philosophy, yeah, I suppose?
Well, I think it's there for all to see, and I think he spoke about it from the first day he comes in. He wants to play an open, expansive style, possession-based and that respect. And at the moment, with 23 points and sat in a decent position, that's working well. So, yeah, again, you know, it isn't prescribed as in the goalkeeper must make this short pass and always play short. It's decisions, you know, and again, that's where it comes in Monday to Friday. You're trying to paint pictures and create that if you are under pressure, there is an out ball forward. You know, it might not just be a driver 70 yards down the pitch, but you might clip into a number 7 or a number 11, and that's to relieve a bit of pressure. So, you know, that framework is there, and like I say, as I sit here now talking to you, it's working well, and the team are doing well. So long may that continue. You know,
so how much of it then is, you know, you're the goalkeeping coach, you're within the umbrella organisation of the management team itself. The goalkeeper might have, for example, the MO at the club might be to pass the ball out from the back like Man City or Liverpool, for argument's sake. But how much of it then is the goalkeeper saying, well, listen, I have to use my own intuition here. As you say, like, you think of short passing that goes wrong. I'm going to go long, I'm going to go down the channels here. I can actually envisage a press and I'm going to just hit the ball long to a pacey winger or something. So how much are you saying to the goalkeeper, listen, you have to make this up yourself?
No. I mean, I think in sort of opposition analysis, which goes on all week and is always happening, then what we're saying is, this is what we'd like to happen. This is how we see us in possession building up. So building through the thirds and all them sort of things is great. If you feel a strong press, if this team, so for example, listen, for example, we're playing Millwall in the Cup at the weekend at the Den. I would envisage, as a Championship club playing against a Premier League club, what will they do? Maybe first 20 minutes, press on and try and create some atmosphere and play front foot. You know, maybe that's when you say to the goalkeeper, and it's not black and white, it's giving them the ownership of, you know, this, you'll feel the picture. If you feel under pressure, these are your outs. These are the next places you can play into if you can't play short. So it's probably just giving them layers, really, you know, in terms of if you play a goal kick to a centre-half 4 or 5 yards away, your job's not done. You're involved in that. You're trying to create an overload and trying to get out into that mid-third. If you get pressed massively and under loads of pressure, your decision, you play into a different area. So no, we give them all the outs and we give them all the answers and solutions. But again, listen, I was a player for 24 years. Ultimately, when the ball's at my feet, I'm in total control. So it's down for me, and that's how it should be. That's how it should be. You don't want a robotic player saying, "Oh, the manager or the coach or the goalkeeper coach told me to do this, so I did it," regardless of what it looks like on the pitch. So, and that's why elite players make the right decisions the majority of the time.
In terms of, you mentioned as well, the goalkeeper position is it's lonely when you're on the pitch, maybe to an extent, but it's those goalkeepers you mentioned that don't play. And Dan and I have often done interviews with, you know, Brian Murphy, who's now at Watford. He spent much of his career effectively as backup. How do you keep them happy? How do you keep them motivated? And how do you keep them? We've had so many debates over here about Kelleher and Bazunu, and Kelleher, you know, should he get a move because he's not playing as much? How do you keep those guys that are essentially almost like born to runner up, to borrow a Simpsons phrase, the guys that are always number two? How do you keep them happy?
Yeah. Well, you've got to stimulate them, you know, you've got to spend time with them. You know, it can't just be, I know this out of experience for myself, and this, it can't just be focused all on the number one goalkeeper playing. We're a unit. So for example, is whether this be international or at my club, is the fact that we'll train all week. And I say to the goalkeepers, I don't pick the goalkeeper. What I do is, I polish you guys up. You know, you're top, top players with top ability. I polish you guys up, expose you to what's coming at the weekend, and then present you in the to the manager and say, these three are ready to go. The manager picks who he wants to play. And once that decision is made, the other two are in a support mode. You know, and if you're talking about supporting the goalkeeper, you know, most times I rocked up for Ireland, I got 11 caps, which I'm hugely proud of, but I was in a support role, albeit I was a Premier League goalkeeper, by the way, playing every week in the Premier League. I was then had to adopt a supportive role to Shea. Now, I was happy to do that, absolutely no problem at all, because once you get over the disappointment of, oh, well, the manager's not picked me, what's your next job? And your next job, if you're a number two or three, is to support the number one, whether that be in the warm-up, whether that be in helping them out with analysis for, you know, penalties and all those sort of things you sit around and help with. I don't want somebody sitting around feeling sorry for themselves and bringing the atmosphere down and being negative. Because what I say to that fella, if they behave like that, is, well, if you're in the team and you're number one, you wouldn't like the other fella doing that to you. So let's be positive and all that sort of things. And we've got a nice environment here, certainly got a nice environment in Ireland. So, you know, that's how it should be. Healthy competition, but we're really respectful of each other. And I think that's what you should be striving to get. You know, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah,
I suppose it helps, Dean, you can speak with authority on that. That I said, you've lived that experience to some degree yourself. It's not as if, say, with Ireland, you'd been the number one the whole time. Like, you had your frustrations, which were documented before. So you actually know what players are going through, and you can say that with absolute authority and credibility that you do genuinely know it.
And by the way, it's okay to be frustrated. It's okay to be disappointed that you're not playing in a team. And that sting of disappointment and frustration needs to be individual, away from the group, and then you need to process it and crack on. So the next time you come out of your room or you hit the training ground with this, that you're all singing or dancing, helping the team. Because ultimately, a squad of 25 players in the Premier League, or, you know, 26 players that meet up internationally, is that we all want to win. You know, we want to be successful. So, you know, you have to take sometimes your individual, you know, them side issues away and go, okay, no problem. And also, listen, it is a cliche, but I think it's played out certainly in Ireland, and you see it sort of weekly in clubs, is that you're saying to the number two and the number three, you are a loss of form, a injury, and a sending off and suspension away from getting in the team. So if that were to happen, are you ready to go? Are you in the best condition? Are you in the best shape mentally and physically ready to go? And if the answer is yes, well done. If it's no, you need to liven up. We need to crack on.
I think it's striking when you reference your own time as a player, Dean, and like, you were a Premier League goalkeeper, and yes, you know, you had to serve your time sort of on the fringes of the Ireland squad. It would have been similar, probably, like right backs at the time. Like, there was a depth of Irish right backs, like absolute top drawer. You look at Ireland today, and it's hard to avoid the discussion because it keeps coming up on these shows and everywhere all the time, that people look at the depth of options that is now developing in the goalkeeping.
This is all down to Dino here. This is nothing to do with talent. This is just, they've exploded into quality all of a sudden.
Just as you arrive, all of a sudden, like, they all come together. But I mean, it is exciting. I mean, it's hard to avoid some kind of excitement around it, that you have, like, and I know there's some good goalkeepers behind it too, like James Talbot we see here and various people, but you have players like Gavin Bazunu, Queevy and Kelleher, and Mark Travers, top of the championship at the moment. Like, for you, it must be a dream to see that sort of that talent reserve there.
Yeah, I mean, it's excellent. I mean, you know, people say to me, now the generation is gone, go, God, some goalkeeper, you and I used to watch in the Premier League, and, you know, it's tough, you know, and rock up and you're 11 caps over behind Shea. But what a fantastic position for Mick McCarthy to be in, to have two Premier League goalkeepers to call upon. You know, he had depth and this, that, and that. And now you bring it forward now, and it does work round in cycles if you look at it. And, you know, I would be aware before I took up the role, with the national team, of Gavin Bazunu and Queevy Kelleher and Mark Travers and James Talbot and Kieran O'Hara. They're the people I've had under my while I've been in and around it. So they're top. They're elite players. And this isn't just just a little flurry of form and it'll fall away. These are elite players and elite people that will be around the national squad for a decade or so, more than that. So that's incredible. That's incredible that you know that when these players turn up when selected, that they're top, that they're excellent. And like I said, I can only speak in terms of the time I've spent with them. And it's got a different rhythm. Obviously, the international scene's got a different rhythm. You rock up, you might be away for 10 or 12 days or 10 days or whatever. But when you look at the schedule, you think, well, I've maybe got 4 training sessions. So you've got to do it right. You've got to set the tone. You've got to set a nice rhythm for them. And again, like I said to you earlier about the club position, is you've got to make them feel comfortable and ready to perform, you know. So it's not about how many cones and poles I put out on my sessions. Again, like I said to you earlier, I provide the framework, but I need their feedback, what they like, how they want to work, the rhythm of how they want to work. And you've got to look after them all. And, you know, like I say, at this moment in time, I'm sat here talking to you now, they're all in amazing form with their football clubs. And when they rock up internationally,
we might have slightly lost Dean there. We'll see if we're getting Dean back. He's what an embarrassment to Rich is. Like, it's just off,
like,
the charts.
No, it is. And like, it is a sort of a really sort of, like, it feels like it's the question we're going to keep coming back to a million times over the years. It's this debate over which goalkeeper should play, which one should be picked. And we just can't avoid that debate. But it's a great problem to have. You know, it is a terrific problem to have.
Dean is back.
He is back. But
Dino, it's like somebody just shut you up there, which none of us wanted.
I think, listen, you don't have to be too polite. If I was boring you, you'd put that X factor, that big X that just shuts people up.
We did try to get Novak Djokovic, but we had to get you.
The Graham Norton chair. The Graham Norton chair that flicks you off midway through.
Yeah. I'm in the big red chair.
But Dean, I was just going to say, and it comes back to our earlier point about, say, again, this whole thing about how the modern goalkeeper operates. But, I mean, it was striking just watching Caoimhín Kelleher play for Liverpool on Sunday, that just when the ball came to him at his feet a couple of times, a couple of the passes he picked, he was so relaxed about it. And, you know, you've probably experienced it in stadiums where teams aren't used, or fans aren't used to this, and there's almost jitters when these type of passes are attempted, whereas now it's probably people are more used to seeing this from their goalkeeper. But it was just so striking how natural it is to him. You know, and is that something that you can see with your keepers generally?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, you know, if you think about in around training grounds, you do play 11v11 on full pitches, but you do put on phases and functions and coaching drills where everything's a bit condensed and there's a bit more connections. And they play out and they play through and they pick and find passes and all this, that and the other. And they do it effortlessly. It looks so comfortable. But again, it's repetition. It's identifying where they can play. And it's one thing knowing where they can play. It's being able to execute it. And like you say, Caoimhín, Gavin, Matt, Travers, all these people, they've got all the clubs in the bag, and they use, and in the main, they use the right ones most of the time, you know?
So you're a busy man. Like, I mean, in terms of the year ahead and the scheduling around sort of managing two roles at once, how have you found that? Like, you know, sometimes international breaks can be a little bit of downtime, whereas you're into work. Like, how have you found that balance?
No, listen, when the opportunity afforded itself for me to come into the international setup, it was a 2-minute conversation. But because, like you say, when the international break comes along, the club thing just sort of ticks along and sort of quietens right down, and there's time off and weekends off and this, that and the other. But me and my wife are of the opinion, our children are all grown up now, of it. It's something that landed in my lap and I wanted to run with it and give it a go. So the schedule doesn't bother me in the slightest bit. And actually what's quite refreshing is that, you know, Steve Parrish, the chairman here, and Dougie Freeman, who's the director of football, when I muted that it might be an option available to me, they were like, well, I'll do it. Brilliant. Great. Lovely. For you individually. It'd be fantastic. So there was no pushback from Crystal Palace, which was nice. And like I say, it's it's great for me to come and, you know, try and make a contribution and help, really. So it works out great, yeah.
Pleasure to have you on, Dean.
Hey, listen, take it easy, lads. All the best.
Thanks, Dean.
Yeah, that was Dean Kiely, from one Irish international to another. Now, before we get to that other Irish international, I have to mention at the top of the show here, this is reverting back to Tuesday, Dan, when I think the computer You know when the computer goes into update mode and you're like, sorry, OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. And Colin Healy will be very well shaved, no doubt. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
I always enjoy being on with you, Johnny, because there's an element that even you're not entirely sure what's coming next. But that element of suspense is enjoyable. You know, you just don't know what could happen.
It's like a really crap Tommy Tiernan. And, you know, he just doesn't know what's happening.
Yeah, it's not that he doesn't know who the presenters or who the guests are going to be. He just doesn't know what he has to say.
Yeah.
Those random things are going to be thrown at you and you're not prepared for any of them.
The Irish goalkeeping situation. If Mark Travers were our starter week to week, nobody would be complaining.
If, like, at another time, we'd be talking about Mark Travers all the time. Mm. If you know what I mean. Mm. Like, you'd be saying, there's an Irish goalkeeper now involved. Like, Scott Parker's come in. You know, they signed a player from Scandinavia, I think, and, you know, you assume Travers, who's the number 42, is going to be pushed aside, but he's not. Like, he's starting regularly for a team that has a very strong chance of being promoted, and normally we'd be hanging off that, and yet barely even, like, he doesn't really get almost any mention. It was always Bazunu Keller, and yet, you know, you have a third choice there who's like, he's doing better than maybe any of Ireland's strikers at the moment.
I want everyone watching the show to watch this very, very closely and ask yourself whilst watching it, and we will talk over it, would Travers, Bazunu or Keller have been able to save this at Turner's Cross? Dan, look at this. What an angle we have of it as well. All we need is...
Some people are listening to this as well, Johnny, so you have to describe it for
this
me.
This is a corner kick coming to the back post. Colin Healy goes up for a header, and then this... Oh.
A stunning overhead kick, it's a ground level fan angle camera from Turner's Cross, but a stunning overhead kick executed into the top corner.
And essentially what I can say to you, Colin Healy, is that look at Turner's Cross when it's heaving. The shed is absolutely packed. People are basically jumping on top of you, jumping over everyone there, and dare I say it, that's exactly what you want to get back at Turner's Cross. Good morning to you.
Good morning, how's things?
Any recollections of that, or like, did you just kind of throw your foot at it and hope for the best, or what happened? Was it a fluke?
You probably could say that, yeah. No, it was just probably one of those things, is that if you did it again, it probably wouldn't have came off.
Like, of all the goals you got in your career, that had to be the best, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. It's probably, we were pushing for the league that year. And I said, listen, it was nil all at that time, so we were pushing to get the goal to beat Pats, and you know, it was one of those things. As you said, listen, it's you don't do it every week, so it was nice when it came off. Because if it didn't come off, I would have been injured, I'd say.
Yeah. Like, it's a special place, Dan, Turner's Cross, when it's even. Oh, you listen, know yourself. Like.
I love it, you know, and I mean it's one of the regrets of this season. I'm sure we'll talk about it, that there's no team from Munster in the Premier Division. But actually, before we talk Cork City, Colin, I was just going to say, because we were just talking about him there, I mean, you are a Corkman. Corkmen are very proud of their sort of local talent. You must be pretty buzzed about Queevey and Kelleher down there. There must be a lot of pride to see someone like him, you know, a local lad involved in a proper global superstar Premier League game on Sunday.
No, absolutely. You know, he's come in and he's done ever so well. He doesn't look out of place when he's playing there, and it's great to see another Cork player playing at the highest level, and hopefully that continues. But it's fantastic to see,
because it must be, like, it says something for even talent production in the area that there's Alameda as well too, who's from Cork. There's, I know he's a bit older, you know, John Egan, but there's a good sort of Cork flavour around that senior squad at the moment, which I guess gives everyone a lift, even in what you're doing. I'm sure it's that pathway that people see to be there, even at this younger age group now.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of talent in Cork. There is. It's just
I don't know why you're smiling like you.
I just think sometimes a lot of people go to Dublin straight away and have a look at the players up there. But no, there is. There's a lot of talent in Cork. There is, and there always has been. There's some good players, as he mentioned there. So, and there's another good young lads coming through the international setup in the underage as well. So
young Heffernan, not too bad.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent in Cork, and it's great for the younger boys now to go on and play at the highest level. And it comes back inherent to our academy that we can speak to our academy players and to say, listen, you do the right things, you get rewarded, you can go on and you can play at the highest level.
So what you're saying there, Colin, is that you subscribe to that Roy Keane theory of years ago that the coaches just always looked at Dublin first. You're on board with that message, right? That's what you're
Absolutely. They're probably looking and saying, oh, listen, Cork's probably another 2 or 3 hours down the road. We're not going down there.
Well, to be fair, people in Galway have very similar complaints at underage level where it's like, oh, you know, as long as these lads around Dublin, that's grand. But there actually are players in the periphery of the country that can do well as well.
Oh, there is, yeah. And I've nothing against Dublin, no lads, just to let you know.
Healy and that shocking anti-Dublin rant.
And you don't have any games there next year anyway.
Yeah, we started this one, yeah.
Come here, the first division though. So like I'm a long-suffering Galway United fan, so we know what it's like in the first division. I was down Turner's Cross last season. Watford are back. Obviously the nine teams isn't ideal. But I've been making the point, the first division has an awful lot going for it in 2022 in terms of the narrative and that.
You know, there isn't, you know, even last year it was difficult. There were some good teams in the division last year and it was difficult. This year, no, again, there's a lot of Munster teams in the division, so there's a lot of derbies. But it'll be a tough division to get out of next year, obviously with the likes of Galway, obviously Waterford coming down. You know, so it'll be a difficult season.
As a young manager, Colin, like what was the challenge of 2021 like? Because it was such a strange time. Like you're behind closed doors for a good chunk of it. Maybe it was a bit more of a transitional season than people might have liked. We constantly speak to players from Cork about how people will stop you on the street and give you their opinion. And I'm sure at times it was pretty fraught down there. Yet you still managed to finish it. Like there was some good crowds coming to the last couple of games. And
notable victory in Galway to screw us over
Well, you managed to let that go, Johnny. Yeah. But like you managed to finish it in as good a position as you could have, I think, maybe in terms of mood, or maybe that's the external view. But how challenging was it? Because there's obviously great demands and expectation down there. They don't want Cork to be in the first division. But like, how have you found just adjusting to that?
It was difficult. I knew what I was getting into. We had a poor start. We had a very poor start and probably caught us towards the end. It was difficult, you know, playing down in Turner's Cross, as you said, you know, when the fans are there to get behind the team, it's a special place to play your football. We didn't have that for probably a good 4 or 5 months. And I think when we did get it back, the younger lads strived on that. And, you know, it created confidence within the team and the players got better. And they loved playing in front of the fans. And as it went on the second half of the season, I thought we were getting stronger and stronger. And the younger players, you could see it, they were growing into themselves. But the bad start, it caught us. And it's just the way it was. But what I would say is that, you know, we started off, weren't great, but we got better and we got better. As I said, from this year, we've added some quality players into the team. Looks like we're a lot stronger than last year. So hopefully that we'll have a good season this year.
Like even when it comes to recruitment, because we joke about the Dublin thing there or whatever, like, you know, you have brought in a couple of players, like you've sort of, you know, Aaron Bulger and James Duna and a couple of players from the Dublin scene. But then at the same time, I think there was maybe a game last season, like there was, I don't know, a large number of your squad had come through the academy there at Cork. Like it was double figures in your match day squad. And like given your background, even coming through the underage, is it sort of a, you know, there's a dual focus there. Like you want the best squad on the pitch, but you want to keep that sort of pathway there too. So was that part of the balancing act with the job?
I suppose it was just probably where we were at the last year. You know, we have to go with the younger players. And obviously I worked with the younger players for the last 2 or 3 years within the academy. But the only thing about it is when you put a lot of younger players in together, you're probably missing that experience, those players on the pitch to listen, you know, when to manage the game in difficult situations. But they've come in, they've grown, they've become good players. So they can hold their heads up high that they went on and they had a good season last year. But the challenge now for this year is, can they go one better? Can they go and be better than what they were last year? Because it's hard when you got a lot of younger players in together, first time playing in front of crowds. when you're not winning. The disappointments, you can see confidence is down. Is how do you get them out of that? And so there was a lot of learning last year for the players and for myself as well.
Yeah, do you ever doubt yourself as a young manager when you know you're having a ropey enough start to the season? Do you have to have, I presume, that self belief that this will work out? I'm doing the right thing. Just give it time here. Or if self doubt creeps in, is that a bad thing?
No, it's not. It's not like I mean, you know, I've been around the game a long time. I mean, that doesn't mean everything. You know, I always looked at the coaching side of things when I was actually playing, you know, of different coaches and what they were doing and what sessions they were doing. I was always interested in that as well. But sometimes you got to make a decision. If you're trying to play, you're trying to play too much football, you might have to change your ways of playing to win games. It's grand in academy football that you're still developing the players and you're asking them to play out from the back and you're asking them to do this, and it's grand to make mistakes because they have to learn, they have to make mistakes. But first team football, as last year we learned, is that when you make mistakes, you get punished. So,
well sure, Colin, sorry, on that, we had Dean Kiely on there. You could even see that with Ireland. Like, Ireland did change their style of football to a larger extent. They stopped playing out from the back at times during that campaign. Things change.
So, I think for me is that sometimes you might have to do it. I mean, if it's not working, you might have to change it. And then if the players get a few results and confidence comes back, then you can slowly bring that back into your style of play. Mm. But I know some managers can be stubborn and they can say, listen, no, this is the way we're playing and I'm not changing it. But if you're not getting the results, and this is just from my point of view, you might have to change the system. You might have to change something to get those results.
When you mentioned the coaches, what coaches had an effect on you? Because you had such a good career as well. And the ones that maybe still stick in your mind on certain mornings.
On certain mornings.
As you get up out of bed, you're thinking of your old coach.
I've worked under a lot of good managers. Mm. There is a lot of them. It's just everybody was different. I just, you know, over in England, that they, how professional they were and the way they put on their sessions and how everything was recorded and your strength and conditioning coaches, your sports science. But listen, obviously coming back over here, we don't have as much as they have over there. So we sometimes gotta adapt to, you know, the staff that we have and maybe double job in around the place. But that's just the way we are and that's what we do. But I'd like to think that, you know, we give all the players here in Cork City the best opportunity to go on and have, I mean, not even for Cork City, to go on and have the best career that they can have. You know, there's a lot of players here that played with Cork City and went on to be international players.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, Colin, like you mentioned, that the demands of the job are slightly different here, as you mentioned, because you have to double job and do a lot more. And, like, I mean, I know it's at the Premier Division level, but a big interest this year is going to be Damien Duff, a former international teammate of yours, going into senior management. Like, what do you make of him going into it, stepping into it? Like, are you as interested as everyone else to sort of see how he gets on?
No, I think it's great for Duffer to go in. Yeah, he's a fantastic coach. He's a great fella. I think it'll be good. Listen, we're playing on the 11th of February, so we'll see him then. But no, it's great. International player. Probably one of the best players that I played with. He was brilliant. And it's great to see him. Great to see him in the league and great to see him coaching. And, you know, the lads up in Shells will probably look at him and listen, feed off the experience that he has and they learn from him and hopefully they want to be better players.
Because it is one of the points that I think Johnny makes here a lot, is at the moment there's no Republic of Ireland born manager managing in, say, in the four leagues in England. Yet you do see, like, you know, John O'Shea has been an assistant and, you know, Stephen Reid and there's a variety of others in various roles. And I think even a couple of years back, the FAI brought a number of ex-players in, I think including yourself, to work with the underage teams at various levels. Like, would you be hopeful in the sort of the decade ahead that we're going to see a lot of your generation come to the fore, if you know what I mean, in terms of sort of major coaching roles? Because it did seem it's gone quiet, it went quiet there for a while, but it does seem a lot of your generation are quite motivated to push on with it.
Yeah, I mean, for me is that, like, I went in and I learnt my trade. Like, I went in with the academy for 2 or 3 years. I went in and worked with Tom Owen in the Irish under-19s for probably over 2 years. And I was doing my learning with them. I was learning off Tom and the way he was dealing with the international players. And I could bring that back into the academy in Cork. sometimes in the academies you can make mistakes, but people don't see it. And then, you know, when you come into first team football, you probably look back and why can't do that, because that doesn't work. And it's just dealing with players. You look at a lot of players, John O'Shea, as you said, Stephen Reid, Andy Reid, obviously he's in Nottingham Forest, and all these lads are going in at 23s, and obviously a system, I suppose others say they're learning their trade. I mean, they could be there for 5 or 6 years, whatever in the role they have, and listen, who's to say they don't go on and be first team managers? But I don't know, sometimes it's that just because you played football, jumping straight in, sometimes it doesn't work.
Sometimes it doesn't work. And if you are new to the First Division next season, you'll have Colin Healy taking on John Caulfield, the old Cork City manager at Galway United. Then you have Waterford back in the First Division, a local Munster derby. So we are doing our bit for rural Ireland. Finally, Colin, I have to ask you, your fellow Cork man, Roy Keane's become a bit of an Instagram hero of late. Is that the route you're going to go down now for 2022 to promote Cork City?
I'm not on social media, so no, I won't be doing that.
That does not surprise me at all, actually. That does not surprise me.
No, not surprising to me.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. Colin, it's been brilliant having you on.
No worries, lads, no worries.
That was Colin Healy. And as I mentioned, there's a lot going on in the First Division this season. Galway United, Cork City, Waterford will be the three teams, I guess, expected to do well. And one of the teams that did well last season was Drogheda United. And this is something that we mentioned as we go through the papers here. Dan's story, New Year dawns. This is in the Irish Independent. New Year dawns with thousands at stake for Irish clubs over compensation rules. And also, Dan, we've got to mention, this is a talking point from Jason Burt. COVID cannot hold football to ransom forevermore. Unvaccinated players should get jabbed or face tough consequences of not playing. It doesn't seem to have been a major kind of talking point in Ireland in terms of players not being vaccinated and all that.
It was. I mean, with the Callum Robinson case.
Sorry,
Stephen Bradley spoke at one point about how his squad had been heavily vaccinated, but we didn't have the regular testing. And I think that's been the case. Like, rugby have had that here, you know, but again, they have a smaller number of players, a smaller concentration of players to deal with, and it's probably easier for them to bubble a bit. Although I think I read sort of pieces earlier this week that not all of the Irish senior rugby team are vaccinated either. So like you saw it last night in general news, I think in Italy, I think they're looking to sort of make vaccinations generally mandatory for people over the age of 50. And I think a couple of months back around the Callum Robinson thing, people probably thought it wouldn't be palatable that you'd get to the stage where vaccination was mandatory, say, to play. But I mean, the longer it goes on, the debate is, pieces like that are starting to move the debate that way. But you saw recently, I think it was in the Mail, it was highlighted, you know, a player who didn't want to be vaccinated because he's vegan, you know, and people will have some sort of religious objections or different reasons that just go beyond maybe basic anti-vax stuff. So it's a delicate one. Yeah.
Should have also mentioned on the back of the endo, this is the Kerry Limerick game. Rocky O'Cunber leads the way for Jack's lads. Another former AFL player who was briefly in the AFL, but Stephen O'Cunber is going to be a big name, I think, in Kerry.
The footage was everywhere of that last night. And they were saying even the technical coaching of how to field is very different than the AFL, and that's given him a massive advantage.
He looks a hell of an athlete. Now, the Irish Examiner, Colin Healy will be getting lots of scrutiny in the Irish Examiner next season. And this is the beauty when you're the Cork City manager, like the local press is all over it. And
Irish Examiner, national paper, of course.
It is obviously with a particular focus on Cork, which is a historical thing. And this is the front of the Irish Examiner today. Making a rod for their own back, Spurs hit self-destruct button at the bridge, which is timely because JD is going to be here in a moment. And Tommy Martin, Ireland's mood for change heavy in the sporting air. That's an interesting piece. References the situation with the women and the IRFU this season. And we also have the Herald, FAI New get bid for your 2028. London stalling. Shocking Spurs defending hands Chelsea first leg boost. That's a photo of Matt Doherty there, Dan, who was taken off at half time.
Yeah, and more speculation around his future again in the last week about a return to Wolves potentially. You've the Examiner there, you've done that already. But it does appear
it obviously couldn't be a bad thing for him at this stage.
Yeah, I know. It's strange because he's had a brilliant year for Ireland. I think if you're talking about Irish players of 2021 in terms of international performances, they'd be well
up there. I love him as a player.
Yeah. But when Conte came in, he played in a couple of different positions, played left wing back initially. But no, it doesn't appear to have happened. He's got Emerson ahead of him there in his favourite position, and the prognosis doesn't look great.
You will remember, if you've been an avid viewer and listener this week, that I brought up how I loved watching Moutinho playing in a game for Wolves.
It was one of those great moments he delivered with authority. Where Joe Moutinho scores.
What a player Moutinho was. I saw him play in the championship. And Dan is like, well, he actually never played.
I saw him play at Preston. I was like, I was there with you that day, Johnny. And he didn't join the club until a year later.
Was it Neves I saw that day?
It was Ruben Neves you saw play that day.
That was a lovely segue there. Never say Neves. United back in for 35 million Wolves star. And, you know, Gillette obviously sponsored the show.
Maybe United had someone at Preston that day who wasn't tanked up, unlike yourself.
No, that's just getting me back for implying that you wanted to go for a few beers after.
Yeah, you
show.
Had a couple of drinks on you that day at Preston. You did.
That was.
I mean, you did. Yeah. You did.
Shh. Hits
me
the
and
fans.
Me and Kilvan were there, and we met the great Trevor Hemmings, who passed away recently, which is a Cork City tangent. And you were absent from that because, as far as I recall, you were doing your thing, networking somewhere.
Networking with myself. Reds high Diaz deal, and yeah, that's an interesting one. Porto's Luis Diaz.
What about the headline at the top? Come on, it's a tough headline.
Shit the fans.
That's right. It's
hits the fans. I actually just gave that headline there.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
Hits the fans. Well, it's obviously a play on.
You didn't give it enough. You didn't give it enough love.
JD's nearly here.
Tab of the morning there.
Before JD comes in, actually no, we'll say it when he comes in. We have to hail him. This is the mayor. You rang, boss. I like that. Because obviously Mike Phelan, apparently things are so bad now with Man United. Ragnick is getting on the old proverbial blower to Mike Phelan and saying, what am I going to do about Ronaldo? What am I going to do about Pogba? What am I going to do about everyone? To see the photo, that iconic image of the United players' body language for the game against Wolves, and you had Jones who's making his return. He's the only one jumping. He's mad get going. The body language was sensationally bad.
Well, what I think has been fascinating about the United stuff, and maybe from my media head, I love, like, you know, you're always looking at stories and where they're coming from, that there seems to have been a blanket briefing that the United players are unhappy, that every different media outlet has a version of the same story. Mm. That the players don't like the coaching, or they don't like this, or they have to Google Rangnick or whatever. You know, there's various sort of things coming out. So it's not good.
Touch of class in the star, which is exactly what JD is, because not only has he just come in unawares, he's pushed a coffee cup over to me, which was requested side of off air.
You're standing in for the week, and you're like one of these stars with a very elaborate rider that need, like, you know, he's got
elaborate
a cup,
rider.
He's got a cup of blue M&Ms there. About. He's got a cup of blue M&Ms there that you need specifically. Like, everyone is bringing in coffees for you, bringing in various sort of things, just because you're not even injured. Like, this whole thing about your injury is, as far as I'm concerned, is a sham.
You're
just being weighted hand and foot on by John Duggan. He doesn't wait hand and foot on anyone.
No, I'm going to continue wearing the boots for months and months and months, because and I should mention the Lord Edward over Christmas. Every time I went out for a vape, everyone opened the door. They were so nice to me, and the Lord Edward followed the epic Christmas dinner that JD had with the two of us, which was basically the highlight of my Christmas. Our beautiful
he
Christmas
the
dinner
steak.
With JD.
Yeah, he did. He's touching.
Happy New Year, lads.
Yeah, he's back.
It's like football.
He
Saturday
is back.
In sort of reverse here. Like, you should break off when JD's making a point. And
well,
go,
Johnny's learned all of his behaviours from me on Saturday afternoon.
But Johnny's going to break off now and go to a score update from Guy Swindles when you're in the middle of making a very coherent point. And, like, JD, no, I have to interrupt you here.
But JD,
no.
You were, I have to say, you were buzzing that day because you had a lovely stint off. Some of us have to come in and work hard over Christmas.
And pick winners in the race and all that kind of thing. I did enjoy my time off at a very good Leopardstown. And I'm really excited about 2022. It's all about the future.
It's all about the future. It wasn't all about Spurs last night, though.
No, it wasn't. And we'll get to that in a second. But I suppose breaking news, lads, that Novak Djokovic is going to spend the next few days in a hotel in quarantine in Melbourne. His deportation case has been adjourned this morning. Obviously, it's the evening in Australia. So he's going to be there until Monday at least. He has had his visa revoked after not sufficiently satisfying authorities over his medical exemption to compete at the Australian Open, where he's a defending champion. He has not revealed his vaccination status, but he's previously spoken out against vaccinations, as we know. In Melbourne, they've had 6 lockdowns. You need to be doubly vaccinated to go and watch the tournament as a spectator. And the Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says the situation's clear.
Rules are rules. It's what I said to you yesterday. That's the policy of the government. And has been our government's strong border protection policies, and particularly in relation to the pandemic, that has ensured that Australia has one of the lowest death rates from COVID anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and the Scott Morrison thing, JD, is fascinating because, as we were told earlier, there is an election
in May. Yeah,
yeah, and this is just nice timing for him. He might win the
extra. He's the hero.
He is the hero.
In Victoria, they would have had two independent panels that would have given Djokovic that exemption. We don't know what the criteria were for the exemption, but the feds have almost just swooped in and said, "No, lads, ain't happening." And is it what's the program called in Australia? Is it Border Force?
Border Force, yeah.
Or is it Nothing to Declare is another one, I think, as well. Generally, when I watch these on a Monday afternoon and it's kind of, I'm bored out of my tree and I'm off or something like that, you turn it on and you get the hard, the hard border people, and then you'd always have somebody with animals or like food in their bags and stuff that they're not allowed to bring into Australia. The Novak Djokovic one would be probably a Christmas Day special.
Yeah,
you'd hope someone's has got on board and started recording this in train, because it did look like he was going to end up in the terminal for a long period of time. So it would have been like Tom Hanks in that movie.
Never seen that.
But it's based around.
Give me a load of movie recommendations.
But it's based around an Iranian guy who spent 18 years in the terminal in Charles de Gaulle Airport in
18
France.
Years.
18 years. Now Charles de Gaulle Airport, in fairness, it's a hell of an airport
bad,
for connections.
It's not that bad.
I don't think he just couldn't find his gate. Like yeah. It was a bit more. He spent 18 years there. It was to do with it was a diplomatic incident, and the terminal movie was built around it. But this guy just wasn't being let into Paris. Now eventually he was let go, and I think basically lives in a shelter in Paris, having left Iran. I think he was on his way to the UK. So he spent 18 years there. Like Novak's 6 hours plus a couple of days in the hotel probably doesn't pale in comparison. But I mean, someone really should be, like, they should be in documentary mode already.
First world problem.
Or, like, finding
the room service guys.
Finding the room service guys. Like, 100%.
Is there steak in the menu, that kind of thing?
Get a GoPro in the room service guy.
Can you practice your backhands and forehands?
Yeah.
In the hotel room.
Do you get energised with the whole vaccination debate, or are you just, like, fed up of everything at the same?
I'm fed up of everything generally, but that's a separate issue.
Coming up on today's show.
That feels like that's quite a broad point for us to delve into before we get to the next story.
We only have 5 minutes left, John, on your slot. Look, it's something that I think hopefully we're going to see a better 2022 than the 2021 if Omicron is, and there are no more severe variants than after Omicron. So that's what we're hoping.
What is that?
That, you know, when things open up, that we'll have a good summer and that we'll be able to travel. And I think travel for me is something that I certainly want to do this year.
Where are you going, John? Where's your book?
Oh, United States. I want to go to Keeneland for the Breeders' Cup. That's definitely in the agenda for November. And what else? Maybe a couple of golf tournaments over there, but definitely the United States sport if I can.
Yeah, I will say that JD was in incredibly bullish and confident mode about his golf tips for 2022.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the Whiskey Sours. It was actually just an erudite JD.
Well, I really do feel that I have my eye in, because I have my eye in at Leopardstown at 5 winners. And I really do feel that this year is going to be the big year. This is going to be the year when things just take off like Cape Canaveral.
Casually dropped into 5 winners there, John.
A bit of a humble brag. I'm well known for the humble brag.
28 races at Leopardstown, by the way, 5.
He didn't have 23 losers. He was selectively betting. And that's what he's going to do in 2022.
That's his whole point.
Extremely selective betting.
Moderation.
Talk of Rory McIlroy, but that's obviously to come. I could be wrong. I'm just speculating here.
Yeah. Well, Rory McIlroy, I think, has got a great chance at St Andrews. If St Andrews is calm, because he shot 63 there back in 2010. I do think he's going to have a good year, Rory McIlroy.
Sorry, I don't follow golf like you two. Freak, but he doesn't win anymore, does he?
He won after the Ryder Cup. He's won 20 times in the PGA Tour.
When did he last win a major?
2014.
That's the issue.
2014. It's 8 years ago. He's supposed to be the best thing ever. He hasn't won a major in eight years.
I've never seen his exercise.
Unbelievable.
But
there's like only McIlroy to win.
There's only four of them.
Something
a year.
In that coffee, sir.
Like it's
well, you give it to me.
Like
coffee now, sour.
The major thing is a problem, but he is still like an elite player. But it's interesting. A lot of the big guns are out this week.
Yeah, in Hawaii.
There's only maybe two of the top 50 missing, I think, or something. Or there's a small number missing.
One of these
anyway.
Tournaments I just can't watch. It's just too late. It's too late.
Well, you could actually. You'd probably stay up and watch the golf now and then intersperse it with Novak in Novak's Border Force live webcam.
And not sleep at all.
Yeah, come in here completely parked up like Johnny Ward.
Yeah, we are supposed to be...
Well, it's funny because I'm not one of these people that drinks coffee because I don't like the taste, but I'd love to drink coffee for the bull around it. It seems like, Johnny, you're like your man out of Pulp Fiction, Jimmy, you know? that you're into the coffee and stuff, and you're probably coffee, I don't know, you've got a coffee cellar and a wine cellar and all that kind of thing.
Well, Rory and I were on Rory O'Connor the other day. It was a national crisis when the coffee machine wasn't working. JD, any sort of things you want to give up on 2022? Dan actually already broke his. He had bread earlier on.
I mean, I've started off on a real health kick. I mean, I've cut out sugar and booze for the first 5 days of the year.
This
is the sixth day, so we'll see how we got on.
Nearly broke yesterday, JD, I have to say. A mutual friend of Dan and I was in the area and passed a lovely establishment in the Dublin 6 region. It was a cold day. It would have been lovely and warm inside, but I was true, and I got true to the 6th of January.
Yeah, you're the real hero here, yeah. John. Yeah.
I know, and I'm absolutely military about my my resolutions at the start of the year, like diet and exercise wise, and no booze. But you know, once we get to things opening up, then that'll definitely change. We'll have a bit of a party.
Dan's talking to Pints on Saturday after the show. What else we got?
Pints of water.
What else is going on in the world?
Chelsea Spurs last night, as you said, they're 2-0. Ben Davies' own goal after Kai Havertz put Chelsea in front. Matt Doherty taken off at halftime is a worry for him. Mm. Thomas Tuchel and Romelu Lukaku, it's all sweetness and light now.
I was pretty sure that he is not affected by it. I saw him on a daily basis, and even in the last days and yesterday and today, he seemed to be relaxed. He seemed to be fine with the situation and also mentally moved on. And I mean, Romelu can handle pressure and he can handle adversity, and it was a good performance. He contributed a lot to our defensive setup and created and had some chances. So good to go again.
Spurs not good, JD?
No Dyer and no Romero at the back, and it really was obvious. I think Harry Kane is still a shadow of the player he was.
Really?
Yeah, I look, he didn't get service in that, but look, in a way, it's a good thing that Conte will have to say to Daniel Levy now, look, I need money, I need players, I need to shape it my way. We'll soon learn who he rates at the club and who he doesn't. But there is Manchester City, Chelsea and Liverpool, and then there's the rest.
Yeah,
and the gulf between those three teams and the rest is big.
Well, but I wouldn't say when Spurs played Liverpool, Spurs exposed Liverpool, yeah, and were well worthy of the draw.
They were, but I do think fans still matter, and Tottenham have always struggled at Stamford Bridge. Mm. Like for 30 years, I think they might have won once there, and it's always been a struggle. And from the get-go, Spurs weren't at it at all. Like it's almost they were intimidated.
But they're in a good position. In 18 points, 33, they're in a very good position to finish fourth at the moment.
They are, but that's almost by default, because United are a mess, as we know, and West Ham don't have the squad. Arsenal have improved in recent weeks, but you know, can you trust them?
And very, very briefly, Dan, it's great to see safe standing in Stamford Bridge for the game the other day as well.
Yeah, no, I mean it's sort of historic in a way that it's returning to the sort of you know, the Premier League grounds, to sort of some of the Premier League grounds now. It is, yeah. I mean, God, you're talking about sort of fan stuff now, and it's so interesting. Twined with the debate about COVID, and you have to remove it from that and think that going forward over the longer term, I think it has to be a good thing. I mean, I think, like, I mean, this is the classic sort of press box view. Like, when I go to games, I'm generally in the press box, so I can't necessarily talk about what it's like to be, you know, in the stadiums, but in a lot of them as well. I mean, you have people standing for a good part of the game anyway, but that's not always convenient for maybe people who are, you know, who aren't as mobile in some ways, and they're annoying them. Like, so there's a balance to be found, and you would hope that safe standing is a positive innovation. And I mean, I think, you know, it can be very safe, you know.
Totally.
It can be made very safe, as the name would suggest.
Yeah, Dortmund, I think, would be a good example of that. I mean, back in 2003, I was in the South Stand of Spurs in the old Wyatt Lane. We're all standing. But yeah, it just regulates it. And yeah, as you say, Dan, makes it probably more fair experience for everybody rather than being, you know, squashed at times, you know. But
it's safer, JD, than people standing as they were, as you mentioned, in English grounds in seated areas, which isn't actually that safe. So safer standing is actually, as it exactly says,
yeah,
in the tin.
Yeah, and when standing existed before, you have to remember that football fans were caged like animals. You know, that was effectively a big part of where a lot of issues stemmed from. It was, you know, they were penned in a very unhealthy and sort of almost inhumane way at times. And then got portrayed as the bad guys when there were some episodes. Whereas if you actually make it a safe standing environment, it's very different.
We've one last news story, if you have one, JD.
David and Paddy Clifford, both on the goal score sheet, as it were, for Kerry last night, 223 to 6 points over Limerick in the McGrath Cup. I think they'll do well this year, Kerry. I think if Jack O'Connor can sort the defence, I think they're going to be definitely thereabouts to win the Sam Maguire Cup. So they started the year well last night, lads.
And you'll see the three of us again on Saturday.
I will, yeah. It'll be goat's milk smoothies and you know, lots of prima donna behaviour from all of us.
Or Johnny or JD will just come in after having a few beers and a load of tapas.
Like dry January's over, yeah. No, that's not going
to
happen.
I'm looking forward to it already. OTB
right,
AM. Great to have you on, JD.
All right, lads.
OTB AM is brought to you live every morning by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. This is what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio across the day. At 1 p.m. OTB Gold, Jerry Eisenberg on Ali. Leaders questions at 3 p.m. Retro panel, how we coach kids at 4 p.m. OTB Gold with Declan Murphy of Centaur, 6 p.m. and obviously at 7 p.m. OTB tonight is live. Up next on OTB AM, Robbie Cannon is joining us. The self-help guide from OTB AM. You'd never thought it would happen. He's the third part of our Off the Couch series as we focus on S&C.
OTB AM.
Yeah, we're delighted to welcome Robbie Cannon on to the show this morning. He's worked with Tipperary Hurlers, Laois footballers over the last few years and is Shane Lowry's S&C coach. Robbie, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to judge the performance that you give us this morning or the value of it by how much the producer, Tommy Rooney, is frantically writing on the Google Doc, because yesterday when Daniel Davey was on chatting about food, he was taking down notes as if he was back in school. So his first point here is avoiding all the fads and cutting through the bullshit. So that's Tommy's line, and he wants to know, how can he become a stronger man in 2022?
First things first is I would advise trying to get some qualified help. So maybe try and get yourself a qualified strength and conditioning coach. If you're going to go a bit more sport specific, you might get yourself a qualified coach in that sport. And what that does is it just gives you a bit of accountability, allows you to set some goals. You'll obviously work on the technique of the movements of what you're going to do, whether it's in the gym or the sport. And it just gets you to set some targets for the year ahead, the months ahead.
I think that's interesting, Robbie, because like I would have gone to the gym a couple of times this week, and because I've had like knee injuries in the past, I know programs to do for like that area, you know, and for the legs and stuff like that. Be pretty confident on that. But with regard to other stuff, probably not so much. And you see people who are like, I'm going to the gym, but they're sort of wandering around, just sort of picking up things and drifting around. And I'm guessing what you're saying is they're probably not going to get the benefit of that experience without necessarily having some kind of clear focus.
Yeah, like even myself, like I set myself programs, and I've done one now for the last kind of 14 weeks, and it's probably the strongest I've been in years. So everyone, if they actually get their own program, it's going to be specific to themselves. They don't have to go in and see the trainer two or three times a week. They can actually go in and get one session with them and say, okay, I'll come back in 4 weeks or I'll come back in 6 weeks. Yeah, you're right. People go into the gym and they don't know what they're doing, and they might see something online, like social media has its benefits, but then again, it has its negatives when it comes to the gym training, and people just try and pick exercises that look cool on Instagram.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a trainer who's giving you a proper program that's actually specific to you, because like some people could be very strong in their upper body and they could be weak in their lower body. What people tend to do is they tend to do the things that they're good at. And as a result, they get even stronger in their stronger part and weaker in their weaker part. So just getting a proper qualified trainer that will actually identify your weaknesses and actually get you a program that will actually get you stronger.
And another point in that, Robbie, when I started in the gym years ago for a brief period, I was on one particular machine. I think it was for strengthening the muscles in your legs. I was doing about three things wrong on that individual machine, it turned out, and I ended up getting back problems from it. And I think that's an important point as well. If you're a rookie in the gym, get people to tell you how to do things properly. That's why an S&C coach would be able to how to actually do the machines as well and how to do your weights properly.
Yeah, like sure. Like if you're going to the dentist, you don't go and see the nurses in the office, you know what I mean? You're going to get because you see the dentist. So if you're going in to do strength and conditioning, you should be going to a qualified strength and conditioning coach. And especially like if you're messing up on a machine, like machines are actually the easiest thing you can do. So you must have been doing something really bad to hurt your back.
Robbie's not too sympathetic to you.
Sorry, Robbie, what's your number there?
were you facing the wrong way? Like, I'm trying to figure out what you were doing.
Yeah, too much weight on, too many reps, just for example. And my body, I was developing. And that's like, I mean, there's nothing worse than if you think you're doing well and, it's no pain, no gain in the gym, but you're actually causing problems. But on the flip side, Robbie, It can do massive help to your self-esteem, and you will see in the gym that in a fairly short space of time, you will notice the difference.
Yeah, if you get the right coach who shows a bit of an interest in you and who sets you a proper program that is periodized, where you get stronger every week, and you touched on it there, some people, the ego can get in the way, and all of a sudden they're starting to lift heavier weights. And then they break down, they get injured, and then that kind of sets them back. Oh, I hurt myself in the gym, and it kind of gives a negative kind of feel on their on going to the gym. So, like, if you get a proper program that's increasing up every week, not too crazy on the weights, it just long term will be just it'll work out better for you in the long term, and you'll stick with it.
You can contact Robbie on his website at canonperformance.ie or Instagram, Twitter for more information as well. Just the usefulness of a training diary as well, writing down what you're doing the next day. For example, you can obviously, you mentioned like Instagram and so on and so forth. You can take photos of yourself and track that progress. But that is important, isn't it? Because it's motivation that this is working.
Yeah, there's a saying that I love, what gets written gets done. So if you're planning out what you're doing the next day, like in all areas of life, but especially in the gym, if you have your program, you're writing down, like, I'm going to do that tomorrow. Then when you go back to your diary and tick that off and put in the weights that you're after lifting that day, that gives you a nice bit of satisfaction that I've actually achieved something with the session. And then also you can look back, if you're still with it going well in 3-6 months, you can look back and look, okay, 6th of January, Jesus, I was doing like a goblet squat 5 kilos and now I'm back squatting 80 kilos. That's like, again, that's a huge boost to your confidence and just gives you recognition of the work that you've done. So, like, I'm a big fan, and something that I always tell my clients is get yourself a training diary, just a training diary only. And also, when you go into the gym, sometimes you're kind of thinking to yourself, Jesus, what weight was I lifting last week? You have your diary there, you can open up, oh yeah, I was doing 20 kg on that one. So it's a couple of benefits of having a training diary.
Yeah, just even on the area like S&C, like, where would you be on setting targets for your clients, Robbie? Because some people just get obsessed with something like, say, losing weight, right? Like, that's it. They just decide that's what they want to do. And it may not necessarily be what they need to do in some cases. You know, they may need to just develop, like, their muscle strength or whatever it might be. Like, how are you in terms of your clients or people who are out there now at the start of January who just decide, I want to lose this by this? Like, would you operate that way or would you take a different approach to it?
Yeah, so every new client that comes into the gym, we obviously start off with a light kind of warm-up on the bike or on the treadmill or something. And the first question I ask them is, why are you here? Because obviously they're coming in, they're taking time out, they're busy scheduled, they're obviously going to be paying me some hard-earned cash that they've earned. And I always say, why are you here? And generally, if they're serious about what they're doing, they'll tell you the honest reason. And sometimes it's people, they just want to get better at their golf. They want to get themselves more mobility. Some people want to get stronger. Some people want to get faster for football. Some people want to obviously lose a little bit of weight. So generally, they will tell you what their goals, if they're being honest. And like, if you're starting a new program, you have to be honest with yourself and actually list out the 2 or 3 things that you want to achieve from it. And if you are honest with yourself and you put the work in, you will achieve them goals.
In terms of you mentioned like squatting as well, in terms of physical exercise, and something that I've referenced a bit in terms of working from home and the pitfalls that can entail, and this is a relatively new thing for a lot of people over the last 2 years, but a lot of people are now kind of sitting down much of the day. They're not really doing kind of proper things in terms of just their working environment. And I imagine if you go to the gym and you get into programs, you can kind of do an awful lot of good for yourself and maybe prevent stuff happening down the line that'll screw you over.
Yeah, 100%. Again, if you haven't gone to a proper professional to get a proper program, that's just obviously going to open up the possibility of hurting yourself, especially if you're not 100% in your technique. So I'd always make sure that your technique is 100% on every exercise you're doing. But again, like, if people are a little bit more sedentary now, sitting at a desk from working from home, like, one kind of thing that I've done with a lot of my clients the last couple of years is, like, mindfulness and meditation has been quite popular the last 4 or 5 years. And I've kind of been advising my clients that they maybe take 5 or 10 minutes out mid-morning or mid-afternoon, and instead of meditating, they just go down and do some mobility work. They can still meditate when they're down doing their mobility work, but like, I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from that. And it's just like 2 or 3 exercises, just gets their body a little bit looser. They feel a lot better about it, a little bit of breathing. If they've had a stressful morning or stressful afternoon, it can calm them on that as well. So a little bit of mobility is always great with correct breathing.
Ultimately, we want to know, how can you turn Dan into Dan Do? Like, what advice for Dan to turn into, you know, a muscle man here on the show?
Yeah, so if I was going to list off 3 things, I'd say obviously get yourself a qualified trainer. If Dan wants to come in here, I'd look after him very well.
Good rates.
I've just moved to Merino, so
he lives right beside that. That's perfect.
I live down the road.
This is a match made in heaven.
I'm really excited around 10 o'clock. Yeah.
Really excited about Damien Duff now, so I can walk to Talca Park. So I think I'll start supporting them for this year.
Forget about Damien Duff, right? How do we get Dan in shape? Come on, Robbie.
So obviously we'll get him a proper program, get him assessed, go through the technique, obviously get his goals set out, and then we'll try and get him to keep a diary of what he's been doing. And obviously what Daniel was saying yesterday on the food, that's quite important, to keep track of your food and how that's going. And then having another kind of checkup every kind of 4 to 6 weeks, just to make sure that we're achieving the progress that we want. But at the end of the day, it comes down to the individual themselves. And what I've found has worked for a lot of people is if they're getting their consistent 3-4 sessions a week, that's what yields results.
Because I remember Darren Clark, when he was talking about his own, obviously you're involved with Shane Lowry. I remember Darren Clark talking about he developed a gym regime, and it always stuck with me. You don't need to be in there for 2 hours. Like, you could be in the gym for half an hour and do an awful lot of good work.
Yeah, actually, I have a good story about Darren. I used to do a little bit of work for his golf school about 10 years ago. And he came in after he won the Open. And one thing that he did, talk to all the students, there was 40 students there. And one thing that always stuck with me was he said he started working with a new sports psychologist, and the sports psychologist wanted him every evening to write down 3 things that he was going to do the next day that were going to help his golf. So one of them could have been like practicing on his wedges 100 yards for 2 hours. The next thing was a gym session for an hour. The next thing could have been reading a psychology book for half an hour. And he ticked them off. And he felt like them little victories each day added up to the big victory win in the Open. Mm. So again, that goes back to the diary and the journal. So it's a nice little tip there that Darren said that day.
And like you mentioned there, that like different clients come to you, and you're working with Shane Lowry at the moment. Like, would you have people like who are, say, golfers coming to you, even like recreational golfers, or just, you know, there's a traditional view that used to exist that didn't belong in golf. You know, it just wasn't a thing that belonged in that sport. And clearly that mentality has changed dramatically over the last 2 decades. But are you seeing that even with sort of the layman, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I've worked with Shane since 2015. And like, I guess I've worked with golfers probably all my career in strength and condition. Obviously, I play golf to high level myself, so I probably have a little bit of kind of exposure to golf in that way. But yeah, I'll work with anybody who wants to get better. And it's not just golfers. I've worked with GAA the last 4 years as well. So I have a lot of GAA athletes coming into me working on their speed and strength and power. But yeah, anybody that wants to get better, I'll work with them. That's a key thought.
It is, like they say about Colin Healy, who's one of the guests in the show, and it's a bit like Roy Keane. They kind of have these eyes that, like, once they look at you, you just want to kind of, you want to please them, you want to do. Robbie kind of has that look as well. If he were my S&C coach, I'd be like, Robbie, I can't let you down.
Because Johnny did say earlier, your gym days were behind you.
Yeah,
you're literally in a protective boot at the moment. Which, like, how are you going to get from protective boot Johnny to healthy Johnny again? It feels like Robbie is your ticket.
Oh, over to Robbie.
Yeah, over to Merino.
Maybe.
I expect to see Johnny and Dan now in the next week, I'd say.
Well, in fairness, like, I have a gym right beside me, but I suppose in a serious point, like, both of us turned 40 this year. Do people get turned off by the fact that, listen, I'm not able to do what I would have been able to do when I was in my mid-20s? Like, what's the point going to the gym in my late 30s, for example?
Well, I had a fella come in to me about 6-7 years ago. He was 65 years of age and first time starting a gym program. Within a year, he got to 2 club championship finals. Now, he was beaten in the vote of finals, but he still comes in, trains with me. He looks probably 15 years younger than when he first came in. And he said this year is the best golf he's ever played. And so you're never too late. You know, I actually think that when you get older, it's more important to be actually doing exercise. So there you go.
I think that's phenomenal.
Oh, listen, I'd be a big believer in that as well. I think some people, they only actually grasp that when they get a bit older and they actually wish that they'd minded themselves a bit more in their 20s to actually prolong their sporting career. Because that's the thing, like, we talk about this now, like, we like to play a bit of five-a-side or whatever, and I generally find myself playing now with, like, lads who are a good bit younger. And you get a little bit more conscious about your age, you know, you get a little bit more paranoid about it. So you actually, it's funny, like, you have that realisation when it almost, you feel like it's too late, but it's not. It's so, definitely not too late.
So much for his mental, Robbie, as well.
Oh yeah, 100%. But then again, you have the positive endorphins from after doing a great session. Like, there's no feeling like it. And yeah, like the longer you leave it, the harder it gets. But once you get back at it and you have that consistency, like moving great, it just will. Like, there's people go on about cardiovascular health and how important it is for longevity in life. But there was a really good long study there a couple of years ago about the amount of muscle that you have in your body is just as important as cardiovascular health.
Do you know? So yeah. I had actually a debate with a doctor about this yesterday. It was just about somebody who told me he'd been prescribed antidepressants, and I was completely blown away by it because it didn't fit what I thought was his situation at all. And I'm obviously not in any way qualified to say this, but I did find, as you mentioned there, if you do a good session in the gym and you go for whatever, you go for your shower afterwards, the high that you get there is actually hard to quantify, and it's hard to relate to anything else. Even sometimes cardio wouldn't give you that buzz.
Ah, definitely not. No, it's just, like, it's one thing that a lot of people say to me. They just feel so great about after doing a really good session, especially if they haven't done it for a while. The first couple of sessions are hard, but then once they get into it and maybe the third or fourth session, they're starting to feel the benefits. They may start to look a little bit better in the mirror, just feel better about themselves. Like, it makes you feel like a foot taller. It really does. That's one thing that's been quite consistent with people's feedback over the years to me.
And just finally, Shane's off to America, then he's off to Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Saudi Arabia. I'm reading this because, unlike Dan, I'm not into golf, but how are things with the Lowry man?
Yeah, he's all good. Actually, he's heading back to America now in the next couple of days. So then he's heading back then, obviously, to Abu Dhabi to start off the 2022 season. So yeah, he's in good form. He's looking forward to the season ahead. He had a great season last year, very consistent in the majors, just proving that he's such a major player. And yeah, I know he's very excited and looking forward to the new season.
And finally, those with kind of voyeuristic or even, I would say, voyeuristic qualities, and they want to see Dan and you in a session, where do they go?
I'm based in Morton Stadium in Santry. And you can follow me on social media there as well. So anyone that wants to get in touch, happy to help. They want to get better.
Absolutely, and it's only the 6th of January. If you haven't started yet, Robbie, there's loads of time.
Oh yeah, loads of time.
Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Cheers.
Thanks, Robbie.
See you.
Is this going to happen, Dan? Are you going? I mean, Marino, like, couldn't be closer. He mentioned Damien Duff as well. He obviously is into football.
But you're easily won over. Like, he's mentioned a League of Ireland reference, and you're like, I want.
I am.
Want to see that guy. You're easily won over. Voyeuristic qualities is like a bit of an oxymoron, really, in some ways, isn't it? Voyeurism be?
Yeah.
Could you say that someone has a bit of quality in the area of voyeurism? Probably not something that would be advisable.
As I mentioned the taxi driver. So I had a taxi driver one day in Dublin, and he's like, I think he was ex-army, and he was talking about one of the lads in the army, and he goes, he used to call him Oxy because his name was Morn.
That's actually pretty good. Your taxi trips around Dublin, like, there's something in that as well too.
Well, I had a debate with Phil about, like, when you get into a taxi, and in fairness, much of the time you're not really in the mood to chat, but, like, I was making the point, like, my cab driver this morning, he was giving out that business is on the floor, he's his first fare, and I was late and he was almost about to leave because he rang me and I didn't answer because my whatever, and he said, like, I'm in 3 hours into the job here and this is my first fare. So, like, sometimes I'm just like, maybe he actually does want to chat, and maybe I'll bring 5 minutes of happiness to his morning.
That's,
you know,
so
which is exactly what it's you've
basically
done this morning.
You're providing a service to tax service. You were doing a bit of anthem whistling over Christmas, I believe.
Biafra.
Yeah, this is, people may not realise that you're, one of your many qualities, aside from voyeurism, is your ability to whistle a national anthem of any country. Just like a click of finger, name an anthem and you'll whistle it. And so you get a taxi driver, you see they're not from Ireland, you see where they're from, and you whistle the anthem. So what happened?
That's a dangerous assumption as well. But I did, this lady like was very fresh in the job. I think she was only a week in. I said, oh, where are you from? And she said, Biafra. And that was like, well, that's,
which is where,
that's quite pointed.
Explain that to people.
So Biafra is a secessionist region of Nigeria. But like, that's kind of like saying, where are you from? And somebody says, I'm from the Basque Country. So it's quite pointed. Well, this person is quite intent on...
Yeah, Cork.
And like, a lot of these countries in Africa, they're very complex. So like, she felt Biafran rather than Nigerian. So of course, I knew the Biafran national anthem. So like, I gave her an old whistle of the anthem. Biafran national anthem is Finlandia by Sibelius, which is one of the most beautiful pieces of music you'll ever hear. And you probably already actually know it. But she's like, oh my God, this is amazing. How do you know my anthem? So a minute later, she's ringing Biafra to say, listen to this, listen to this. You know, this lad knows the Biafran national anthem. And didn't get any reduction on the fare.
I was just going to say, well, she's new on the job. She's not in a position to be just thrown out freebies at this stage. You've literally talked about the problems of the industry, and now you're suggesting your little anthem trick should get you freebies.
Great having you on.
It's been good, Johnny.
OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Good mornings, obviously, start with the Biafran national anthem. Packed show ahead tomorrow morning. We'll be kicking off our Irish rugby depth chart with Alan Quinlan. We're talking football and bringing you the first crappy quiz of 2022.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.